I'll call the meeting to order, and we'll first hear Representative Faust's bill. We do not have a quorum, so we will start without a quorum, and we'll note that Representative Ward, Jensen, Biskins, and McFarland are here, along with, of course, our bill author, Representative Faust. And we can't remove your bill or do amendments, Representative Faust, because we do not have members here on time. But we will start with your testimony because we're on a very tight schedule. We have 15 minutes for each bill today and another 5 or so for the last bill, which is controversial. So you have until 3 o'clock, and that includes we have to get in one testifier from the public who wants to testify on this bill. So go ahead, Representative Faust.
Right. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill. I'll assume that the amendment is going on, and we'll give testimony, assuming that that is
yes,
the situation.
Representative Faust and the staff will let me know the second we have a quorum, and we will take care of that.
Very good. Okay. With that, I'm actually going to let my testifier speak first. I have with me Chris McHugh, who's retired now from SCRED, who many of you probably know and recognize. Dr. Ann Casey, the director of the RTI Center, which we funded 2 years ago, and Laura Daigle, who is a teacher from Malacca School. So with that, I'll turn it over first to Chris McHugh and let him talk a little bit about RTI and what that does.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. McHugh, and you're way too young to be retired. Please restate your name for the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris McHugh, and I'm, as the Representative Faust says, I'm the retired director of the St. Croix River Education District, and here today on behalf of Dr. Kim Gibbons, who is unable to attend. We deeply appreciate the confidence the legislature showed in its 2007 session in appropriating funds for us to disseminate RTI, response to intervention. With the funds you gave us, we created the Minnesota RTI Center. We did not create a separate entity, but rather formed a center that operated under the supervision of the Education District Board. We selected Dr. Ann Casey to direct the center. Ann was a founding researcher in the RTI process and has worked for the Minneapolis schools. We located Dr. Casey at the University of Minnesota within the offices of the Educational Psychology Department, one of the top such departments in the nation. We also created an advisory board with representation from across the state to ensure a statewide perspective. And indeed, the activities of the center have taken us into every corner of the state. Using response to intervention, the schools at the Education District, which we call SCRED, have achieved 3 important policy objectives, and they're in the handout information that I think the staff has provided you. There are 4 graphs, and those of you who are on this panel 2 years ago have those. The first one, which shows that we increased achievement for all students over the last 12 years, specifically, the percent of students on target to pass the MCA testing has increased significantly. The second chart shows that we increased achievement for most challenged learners, those students within the lowest 10th percentile. And, Madam Chair, I'm not explaining these charts because of time limitations, but I certainly could meet with any members afterwards to do that. Then the third thing that we did was reduce placement into special education, and this is on the next page, specifically by cutting in about half the number of students identified as learning disabled, the largest category of special education. Recently, we reviewed our progress and our proposal to merge RTI with CUCOMP with Commissioner Segrin. The message we have is that using response to intervention means that all students improve, progress for students at the bottom of the achievement range is improved, and fewer children are placed into costly special education programs, allowing teachers to teach and not do as much paperwork. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We now do have a quorum, so I will move House File 2133 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And having that bill before us, I'll move Representative Faust's amendment, his author's amendment, H2003A1. Any discussion on that amendment? Representative Faust, do you want to give us just a second to tell us what that amendment does.
I sure can. Thank you, Madam Chair. What the amendment does is it actually takes the RTI and puts that into QComp so that it brings the two together. And the reason for that is one of the reasons that one of the issues the legislative auditor brought up about QComp was that they had a hard time identifying whether there was any increased performance on the learner's part. And by putting RTI in there, we'll be much more likely to be able to measure that performance enhancement.
Okay, and this will get the bill before us in the shape that the author wishes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Next testifier, if you could identify yourself and your title and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ann Casey, and I'm the Director of the Minnesota Response to Intervention Center. And thank you for having us today. I'd like to just briefly take you through the handout that we provided with you. The first two pages of that handout are just kind of a litany of things that we've been working on over the past 2 years. And I just want to highlight a couple of those things. We've been very involved in professional development around the state. In November of 2007, we conducted 9 regional full-day presentations on introductions and response to intervention for over 1,200 educators. Just this past week, we completed a 2-day conference here in Bloomington. We had a capacity crowd of 450 with people still wanting to come and attend our conference. We've had a number of other professional development opportunities. Those are just a couple of them. Another thing that we're working on is trying to get more content about response to intervention into higher education, and then to that end, we're developing 15 different content modules for higher ed faculty use. Those are we have several developed, and the rest of them we're completing this spring. They'll go on a Moodle site for downloading by professors. And the intent is that they could just take the content that they're interested in and embed it in the existing coursework that they may teach at their institution. Some of the other things that we've been doing is one of the main things we've been doing is focusing on coaching support to over 50 schools across the state of Minnesota. These schools have been divided into 5 cohorts depending on the basis of their own ratings of their readiness for implementation of response to intervention. Each of those schools has an identified coach, and that is the person that I work with. And in the group of schools that I work with, we meet weekly in an online distance learning model where people sit in front of their computers, I can show them slides, and we have a phone connection, and they're with a cohort of people, and we talk, and it's a very supportive environment where people learn from each other. It's also quite efficient, as you can imagine, in one cohort of people, I have someone from Orr, from Redwood Falls, and from Parsons Prairie. So those are just some of the things we've been doing. We do have a bit of data that we would like to share with you from our coaching sites.
I'm just going to say, I know there's one more testimony. We've got about 6 more minutes. There's a member of the public that wants to testify, and members may have questions, so we can't take up the whole time with testimony. So please continue, but we'll have to cut off the third testifier if he takes too much longer.
All right. I think I'll stop then, because she has some data that we would like you to see, and it's on the last page of her handout. This is from the school that's been implementing RTI for a couple of years now, several years.
Very good. And members of the committee, we did have a whole hearing, the members that are continuing, which is most members in your area on this topic, and I think members are generally, this is not a new topic. So thank you very much. Next testifier.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman. I'm Dr. Laura Daigle, and I'm the RTI coach and early intervention literacy specialist at Malacca. And if you look at the data on the last handout, the colored graphs, I would like you to call your attention to where we were as a school in student performance before RTI. That would be the pie graph up in the upper left-hand corner, where we, in the spring, 6 years cumulative data, only 42% at grade level. Then if you'll look at the pie graph on the right-hand corner, our entering kindergarten students, that should be from September 08, not 09, that's a typo, sorry about that. Letter sound fluency, our entering kindergartners came to us only 26% at our expected grade level cutoff. Then look down at the next cone graph where it says kindergarten LSF, letter sound fluency, 08-09 winter. We've brought those students from only 26% at benchmark in the fall to now 65% at Benchmark now in the winter and on our January Let Us Down Fluency. I'd also like to call your attention to our cohort progression and achievement from the upper left-hand cone graph, Kindergarten Let Us Down Fluency, LSF 0607, and follow that same group of students to fifth grade. We switched the measure now to ORF, which is Oral Reading Fluency, 0708, and then we'll look at the cone graph again for second graders this year, winter data, Oral Reading Fluency, 0809. And what has caused, what are some of the reasons for this phenomenal growth? And it would certainly be attributable to research-based professional development, and we have evidence-based interventions. We also do frequent progress monitoring, and the Minnesota RPI Center cohort has been a big part of being able to know what's working and collaborate with other people across the state. So thank you for your time and letting me present.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I can go after the testifier.
After the last, the public testifier?
Sure.
Okay, any other questions from members? Dr. Ephraim, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Please state your name and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch. As I have discussed with Representative South in the last session, we absolutely support intervention that may prevent or forestall special education referrals and costs and intervention. We absolutely support that. We have always been concerned and were very concerned when this bill was inserted in the last few hours of the session that the behavioral part of that is not well defined with regard to types of intervention, consent for parents, and data collection as far as what goes into a child's record, and we would humbly and respectfully ask that those issues be dealt with sometime.
Very good. Thank you very much. Rep. Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one of the testifiers and whoever wants to take it, that's fine. As I look at this sheet right here, I look at the appropriation. We're asking for $1 million in a time when the state's facing a $6.4 billion deficit. So just to look at other potential funding sources, I don't know, items such as large-scale training, professional development products, technical assistance to schools, and coaching for schools, can they be considered appropriate use of federal early intervention dollars? And so the St. Croix River Education District can charge for those services to the schools, and the schools can recoup or can pay for those charges out of federal early intervention dollars.
Who would like to answer that? If they could identify themselves so the tape knows who is talking. Mr. McHugh.
Madam Chair, Representative Diskins, the bill specifically requests or suggests using stimulus money to fund the center. If I understand your question, Representative Diskins, the question is whether the center could operate more on an entrepreneurial sort of basis by establishing itself and then recruiting business. Because this is was used in one-time money, we made the decision when this was established to make this a program of the St. Croix River Education District, and I don't believe those districts would be in a position to take a risk of that sort in establishing a center that may or may not be able to generate funds to pay for the staff. That would be my... Did I misunderstand?
Yes.
Certainly your question about whether the stimulus funds could be used
local school. That's not my question. I know that every public school has available to it on a request basis federal early intervention dollars. It's part of the title programs. Is the activities listed here, could a school use its federal EIS dollars to purchase those services from the St. Croix River Education District?
We're going to have this answer, and then we're going to lay this bill over. Mr. McHugh.
Madam Chair, Representative Biffin, the answer is yes, although many districts have already committed their 15% money already. Thank you
very much. House File 2033, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Benson, you were here on time. The minutes of March 26th.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the minutes of March 26th.
Mr. Benson moves the minutes of March 26th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Representative Mariani, and you were here at the beginning, so I'll just let you know each bill has 15 minutes total, and you have two testifiers. One member of the public has asked to testify, and of course, as you know, we have member questions. Many members on finance are on policy, so we don't have full-blown hearings in the finance committee, particularly at this point in session and also when they've had full-blown hearings in policy. So, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I will be brief and then allow my testifiers to take most of the time. This bill was heard in early
talk. Representative Mariani, if you could start out moving.
Oh, yes, of course. Madam Chair, I will move House Bill 1046.
Representative Mariani moves House Bill 1046 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, this bill was heard in early childhood committee about a month ago, Representative Flowers committee. The Minnesota Green Corps is an initiative that trains early childhood program staff and K-3 staff in teaching literacy skills, early literacy skills for children ages 3 through grade 3. It's a statewide program. It began in 2003 with state funds as a pilot program. It uses, so this is important, members, it uses federally funded AmeriCorps members to work one-on-one with children throughout the state in the delivery of these literacy skill enhancement services. The model has been evaluated to be quite effective. We'll hear a little bit about that evaluation in a few minutes. It serves thousands of students statewide. It's one of the largest, I didn't know this, it's one of the largest AmeriCorps programs in the entire country. And because of that, Madam Chair, members, Minnesota gets a really good leverage of federal resources to match up with our state appropriation on at least a 3-to-1 match. The governor recommends continued funding the program for Minnesota Reading Corps at the current $1 million a year base level. This bill would seek $1.5 million a year appropriation so that we can increase outreach to 25,000 students statewide to be served. That increase will yield a federal match of over $15 million in the value of the AmeriCorps service student volunteers and in administrative costs to help administer the program. And members, I don't know the fate, but I know that this morning, apparently, and my testifiers may know, this morning the Congress was debating the Edward Kennedy Service Act, which sought to triple the size of the AmeriCorps program. And so we're going to have a built-in capacity if the bill is successful through Congress. The President has promised to sign the bill if it reaches his desk. We're going to have potentially a strong, ready supply of young people to provide these services. So I'll stop at that. The bill asks for both the base funding that's recommended by the governor, but also an extra $500,000 in order to dynamically leverage those great federal resources. And Madam Chair, I have two testifiers with me today. Mr. Steve Shank, who is, I think, former CEO or current?
Former CEO, now chair.
Former CEO and chair of Capella University. He's been active in this effort and has done a terrific citizen job of raising and leveraging private monies to match, as well as
Marianne, a third of your hearing is over. A third of your hearing is over.
I'm just about there. And then my final witness is Carrie Bowman as well.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shank, do we have breaking news?
There is breaking news.
Please identify yourself.
I am Steve Shank. I'm the chair and founder of Capella University. I do understand there is breaking news that the House acted favorably on the legislation that Representative Mariani discussed today, and that's about all I can communicate. But I just wanted to add a word as a person who is involved deeply in education and in our business community, asking the House to support the Minnesota Reading Corps. From the perspective of the business community, this is an effort which touches our neediest at-risk kids at the age where they are most influenceable, age 3 to grade 3. High leverage, as Representative Mariani has already said, with both federal, state, and private funding, which I'm helping to acquire. And the thing that has really attracted me, a serious commitment to data, collecting outcomes, and using that to continuously improve the results. The program works. It is infinitely replicable. Our objective is to take the number of children served in Minnesota from 15,000 now to 25,000, with the request that the state funding be increased to $3 million for the biennium. My commitment is to assist in raising an additional portion of private funding. Last time around, we raised $1 million over the biennium period. Our commitment is to raise $1.5 million. And I have been in the field of both business and education for a long, long time. I've never seen a program with this kind of leverage of public dollars touching an area of serious need. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bowman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Bowman. I work for St. Clair River Education District. It's through my role at our Reading Center that I work as evaluator for the Minnesota Reading Corps, and I'm delighted to be here with you to share some highlights from the impressive program outcomes. If you'll turn with me to page 5 in your handout, you'll see 6 years of data for our preschool reading corps participants on 5 important pre-literacy measures. Notice that for each measure across years, the percent of students meeting our spring target has steadily increased. And on page 6, performance of students who participated in reading corps prior to starting kindergarten in Minneapolis was compared to a matched sample of Minneapolis kindergarten students who had not participated in the Reading Corps program. Our MRC participating students scored significantly higher on district kindergarten entrance assessments than those who did not have the benefit, indicating their enhanced readiness to excel in school. Turning our attention to outcomes for K-3 students on page 7, you'll see that this year we have just about 89% of participating students who are making more than a year's growth in a year's time. This means that students who were selected for the program on the basis of being behind grade level expectations in reading are catching up to their peers. Next on page 8, you'll see that 85% of the students in the pilot sample we analyzed who successfully participated in our Reading Corps program went on to score at or above proficiency on the 2008 MCA2 in reading. Survey and interview data reveal that the MRC participating schools have embraced best practices that our program promotes. Members tell us that they are overwhelmingly committed as lifelong advocates of childhood literacy. In these ways, the benefits to the individual participating students are spilling over into a wider Minnesota community. I'd like to thank you for your support for this innovative and effective program.
Thank you very much, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just a quick comment. I appreciate and respect the Marine Corps program, what you've done in districts. I have it in my district at the TCC Head Start Center. I've been there. I've observed it, and it's wonderful. I wish Representative Foster was here as well. I'm just hoping that, I know you have a 1.5 and a 1.5 appropriation request. We also have a number of literacy programs, reading programs throughout the state that are looking to train teachers to become coaches and things as such to make an impact as well. And I just wanted to say that I wish that we could take some of the dollars and spread them out in a number of programs. And I talked to, I think it was Joel, Representative Mariani?
Josh,
thank you. About that possibility, maybe using federal dollars and recovery dollars. So I wanted to just make sure that I had talked about that. Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to summarize, there's $3 million from the state, $1.5 million in private. What was the federal match?
Three to one, I believe.
I believe it is now at $15.5 million, but potentially more than that. And I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's order of magnitude.
So our $3 million investment would bring. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Our $3 million investment would bring in $15.5 million into the state.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Shane.
Yes.
That's a great investment. Thank you.
It's a great program, and like the last one, we are familiar with it and like it, so that's part of it. We have rush hearings in general, but at least these we're familiar with. There's one person that's asked to testify from the audience, Dr. Ephraim. Is there anyone else?
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Ephraim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Karen Ephraim from EdWatch. EdWatch is always appreciated, especially Representative Mariani's, but this committee's concern in general for the achievement of poor and minority students and closing the achievement gap. And we do support, if there's going to be early childhood programs, they should concentrate on academic issues like literacy and not non-academic social and emotional issues. We would only suggest that this legislation mention what clearly works, which is phonics, and not just say data-based practices. And I have, for the committee's information, a set of studies on what works in closing the achievement gap for poor and minority students, which is namely two-parent families, phonics, and real parental involvement, not parental involvement programs, and not whole language. So that's all I would say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We actually have 1 minute left, Representative Mariani. You can make a closing statement if you want.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I think raises a good issue. I am aware of some of the other programs. One was actually started by the St. Paul Foundation in my own district. Very good programs that have statewide application. The only issue that I would obviously remind members is that this one has this terrific leveraging of federal resources through the AmeriCorps program, but I would hope that we would find ways to be able to effectively deploy effective programs throughout the state.
Thank you very, very much. And Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 1046 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very
much. Thank
you. Representative Grasso has a bill that we have not heard. He introduced it early in session, but he just recently, after chastisement from the chair, turned in a hearing request. Welcome, Representative Grasso, and you can move your bill.
Madam Chair, did you want this on the consent calendar?
Maybe not.
No? Madam Chair, I move House File 1177 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Grasso moves House File 1177 for possible inclusion. Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I get started, I got to give a shout out to my secret senator friend in another state. I actually had a Democrat senator from another state contact me about this bill, and she was very interested in it, but she wanted to remain anonymous. And I said, well, if you wanted to know how the testimony goes, why don't you pull up the tape on this and listen to it, or have your staff do that. And I promise I went out. I just want to give a shout out and let her know that I remember her, and she's going to be listening out here today. So I expect a phone call from her confirming that she actually listened to this hearing. So now, if she doesn't call me, I'll know that she did actually listen to the hearing. So, Madam Chair, members, the Early Graduation Achievement Act would award scholarships to those students who both meet the standards of graduation and choose to graduate early. The scholarships would increase in value depending upon how early the student graduated. The earlier a student graduates, the larger the scholarship would be. The Early Graduation Achievement Act is a thoughtful, pragmatic idea which would help make college more affordable, reward academic, encourage academic vigor, and simultaneously provide an option to our state to help reduce the over $6.5 billion budget deficit we face. And Madam Chair, members, just to prove what a great idea it is, even our friends at the Minneapolis Star and Tribune wrote an editorial about how the graduation plan was worth studying, and in their words, quote, "The Early Graduation Achievement Act is the kind of cost-saving idea that deserves a closer look. If done properly, the scholarships could deliver two important results, saving tax dollars and making higher education more affordable for more students." Madam Chair, members, that's my presentation. There's a couple of testifiers, but I'm happy to sit for any questions from members.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members before we start on the testimony? Hey, who is the first one? If you could identify yourself and give us your testimony, welcome.
Sure, I'm Tina Armstrong. I represent the Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented. And for those of you who don't know, MCGT is a support and advocacy organization for parents and educators of gifted and talented kids. My interest in this bill starts with personal experience. I've got a 16-year-old who's going to graduate here in 2 months and go to Hamline. And as you may or may not know, that at age 16, if they're going to school, guess who gets the loans? It's the parents. So when you've got the kids graduating early, they're not eligible for a lot of the student loan programs. MCGT has been advocating for acceleration for quite some time, and early graduation is one of 18 types of acceleration listed in the Templeton Report on Acceleration. We have been trying to educate for the use of this very broad definition of acceleration to include all these different types. Every time we talk about college courses at younger ages, the questions about social and emotional aspects come up, and I want to assure the committee that this report shows great research to support acceleration specifically and specifically early entrance to college. MCGT wants to thank the representatives that have supported acceleration procedure requirements added to the Gifted and Talented Program Statute in 2007. With more accelerative opportunities becoming available for gifted and talented students of all ages, grade skipping, online courses, AP, concurrent and dual enrollment, all of which my kid has done, early entrance to college is likely to become a reality for more students. We feel strongly that this bill will motivate students who are academically ready to handle college coursework, and there are a lot of them, to complete their high school graduation requirements and move on to college. We think it makes fiscal sense since the cost of the scholarships is less than the cost of keeping these kids in high school environment and trying to meet college level needs in the high school. So that's my testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Graffa, you said you had a second person?
Oh, I don't know if there's a second person. No.
Nope. Is there anyone here that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Hey, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, any idea how many students may take advantage of this program or could be affected by a program such as this?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, you know, one of the complexities in this is that how do you model behavior? How many people are going to participate? And a conservative estimate, I've estimated that about 8% of high school seniors would participate in the program. That works out to about 5,300, 5,400 students on a statewide basis annually. That would include, you know, juniors and seniors who would participate.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Raffalo, what incentives would high schools have to, you know, to encourage their students to graduate earlier?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, the legislation is designed, the current operating levies, the referendum amounts would stay with the local school districts. In addition, as I've stated publicly, I'm open to providing transition assistance to local school districts to maintain this program. So in that regard, it would actually increase per student being served in the school district, actually increase funding on a per student basis.
Representative Detmer, that was it. Okay, any other questions? Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, what impact do you think this would have on programs like IB?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, this program is not intended nor meant to replace these programs or eliminate any programs. It's meant to augment them and encourage them. I think a more related program would be PSEO, the post-secondary enrollment options, where I think you would just see this as being another option. It's not meant to replace anything. So in terms of its impact, I would think it would be minimal.
Representative Depsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a little bit, Representative Garofalo, that this is another option. Do you see any interaction between this program and the PESO program and how the schools would, counseling staff would coordinate that with the students, or do you have any recommendations for that?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Depsey, as with any education decisions, the best decisions made are a three-legged stool where we're working with students, with parents, and with teachers and administrators. I would see this program being no different than that. In terms of a specific tie-in to PSEO, I think that what we're trying to do is take the PSEO concept, the ideas and all the goals that we want to achieve through PSEO, we want to broaden that and expand it. And for many people in the room who've attended college, the PSEO program seems simple, it seems easy. But for those parents or families who maybe aren't from a college-educated family, it can be a little bit intimidating. Simple questions like, how does my child get from the high school to the college? We don't have a car for that. We haven't decided where we're going to college. So if I enroll in PSEO and we use college credits, they transfer to where we're going. One of the benefits of this program is instead of PSEO, which is excluded to a certain percentage of high school juniors and high school seniors, is it opens it up for everybody. And to use a marketing term, it has curb appeal. That's very simple, easy, and direct for parents to understand. If junior work starter, mom and dad got $5,000 or $7,500, they don't have to pay in college costs. So with regard to that, again, I think that it's the PSEO, the term I've used is using PSEO turbocharge. So it expands the size and scope of that. And then just a final point I'd like to make, Madam Chair and Representative Depsey, is that a lot of the areas where we're seeing growth and employment are in areas that are actually outside of the traditional college system. My personal profession, I'm a network engineer. I work on routers and switches. And you all know this already, but we learn a little bit differently. We don't need to go to school for 4 years. We're much more in the information technology field. We're much more goal-oriented. They tell us what we need to learn, and we binge study 12 and 14 hours when we get to that level. Right now, for kids who are going to be CCNAs, CCNPs, Cisco and Microsoft certifications, the PSEO program doesn't really work for them. And it's amazing because if you look at the jobs that are in our marketplace where we have the lack of skills that we need to fill in this job market, it's those very jobs. So we are basically, what this would do is it would incentivize kids to learn in a profession to fill the jobs that need filling in Minnesota. So it meshes very nicely with that regard.
Representative Depsey.
Yes, so you see this maybe being a boost for the students that would normally go on to technical college after high school. Is that correct?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Depsey, to a certain degree, kids who are going to technical schools can use the PSEO program, but this would expand that. It would make it more choices for more students.
Thank you. Ms. Armstrong, I'm curious, your daughter or son is going to Hamlin, you mentioned, and I do know that that costs more than, per year than $2,500. And I'm wondering why your daughter would choose to go with this bill rather than PSEO, which would actually pay the full amount.
It is my son, and actually he has taken some PSEO courses, mm-hmm. and he will still be graduating at 16. So he has focused some of his PSEO coursework, but he's still in that situation of graduating early. And he actually could have graduated at credits through all of his PSEO stuff yet another year early, but he waited till spring of his senior year to take his physical education requirement.
And Madam Chair, this one correction for a student who graduated a year early, it would be $5,000, not $2,500. It's $2,500 for each semester.
Representative Garofalo, right, but PSEO could be four semesters and the full amount, which could be $20,000. And so you're $7,500 if they, you know, chose the PSEO. It seems to me it doesn't cover quite as much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the PSEO program is not available for every course and for every every university in the state of Minnesota. Whether it is for Hamline or not, I don't know.
And Ms. Armstrong, actually for Hamline, they have a list of about 20-25 courses that you can take through PSEO, but the large number of the specialized courses are not available through PSEO.
Thank you very much. Representative Stetmer, you get the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, again, this is a voluntary program. A lot of students, they get enough credits to graduate early, but they decide to stay in school and you know, be with their friends and take other courses. So this is a voluntary program.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Detman, that's absolutely correct. Totally. If a kid wants to stay in school, that's their choice, obviously. Madam Chair, there's no other...
Representative Garofalo, there is not.
Okay, then I'll just make a closing statement that I think the Chair thus far has accomplished what I think is a fairly impossible task, and that is that face of the $6.5 billion deficit, she's managed to keep the House Ways and Means Committee off of our back and actually prevent any cuts to this committee, with the exception of taking the K-12 shift to a 27%, but that's a different issue for a different time. But I think it's important for members to understand that if we go to the conference committee process, outside of whether this body decides to raise whether we decide to raise revenue or not, that the Senate has a pretty tough position on K-12. And at some level, when we compromise with them, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that K-12 is going to be coming in below our House target. And when that happens, we're going to need to present some options to the Chair and present some solutions for how to meet that target. Doesn't mean we have to like it, but just having a little bit of foresight, I think it's important for the committees to at least keep this option on the table.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And I'll say, since we have a minute or two here, that the Senate, you know, we have to never just take what's before our eyes. We have to remember that the Senate at least says they didn't do any shifting. They raised taxes $2 billion when the House only raised taxes $1.5 billion. And then when they had their 7% cut, they hadn't yet spent their federal stimulus money. So it may be that the Senate has even more money on the table than the House. It's hard to say, but we do know that the governor's plan has a $2.5 billion hole, not counting inflation, in the second year, which we voted for the Broad Amendment, and we have to account for that biennium. So everything around here is not always what appears. But thank you for one of our more interesting hearings this session.
Well, I'm one of the most interesting guys, right?
No question.
Somebody more interesting tonight, right?
Hopefully not. Motion that House File 1172 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Davney. Thank you. We know he'll be on his best behavior because we'll be in his district. And also, we have checked with his aunt, Chris Henry, who actually works for the House GFL caucus. Admonished him to behave himself. Aunt Chris. Representative Davney, I'm not sure if you were here right at the beginning, but we're on a very tight schedule. Every bill up until the last bill, which is controversial, and we have some controversial amendments, is going to take 15 minutes, and I know you have a lot of testifiers. I want to let you know that there are four people who want to testify on your bill besides your testifiers, which means we need to finish your part of the hearing by 22.
Madam Chair, my testifiers are aware of it, and they've even brought a timekeeper along.
Representative Davney, that's wonderful. If you would care to move your bill.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1702 to be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 finance bill.
Representative Davney moves House File 1702 for possible inclusion. Representative Davney.
Madam Chair, Minnesota provides a wide range of public high school choice options, magnets, charters, post-secondary enrollment option, international baccalaureate, advanced placement, college and school, and if Representative Garofalo gets his way, even more. Each of these programs meets different school, district, and most importantly, student needs. As policymakers, our goal should be to support students in achieving at a high level and assuring districts of the resources needed to build and maintain those program choices. What is particularly important for us to remember is that by supporting a variety of rigorous academic options, we not only meet the needs of those students accessing those options, but also strengthen the teacher corps in the building through the training that they receive, providing stronger teaching opportunities to all the students in the building. Madam Chair, with me today I do have a number of testifiers. I'll begin with Ms. Susan Henderson, who is the director of the University of Minnesota College of Continuing Education Pre-College Program, unless I'm supposed to give it to somebody else.
Ms. Henderson, if you could state your name and title for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Susan Henderson, and I'm Director of Pre-College Programs at the U in the College of Continuing Ed. This bill places all three accelerated learning programs under one funding and reporting mechanism. The three programs differ in significant details, but all have a common goal: to accelerate student learning in high school. All three allow students to earn college credit, and all three offer professional development teaching. The handout, Making the Case, demonstrates what you might learn if you had the data all in front of you together. So looking at that, which the white with black in the room, you'll see in sections 1 and 3 that the state's investment is highly disproportionate among the programs when you consider how many students are served by each program and how many students earn college credit for participating in each program. In section 2, you'll see that the programs have very different requirements for professional development. In the same section, notice that two of the three programs exist throughout Minnesota, while the third does not. Finally, in section 3, you'll see that colleges nationwide grant credit for AP and concurrent or dual enrollment at almost the same rate, but they grant credit for IB test scores at a much lower rate. I want to return to the differences and similarities among the programs. NASEP accreditation, that's accreditation by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships. Accreditation by NASEP guarantees that a program has met national standards in the area of curriculum, faculty, student services, assessment, and program evaluation. Accreditation does not mean that all concurrent enrollment programs have the same curriculum or grading policies. It does mean that the accredited programs deliver the same quality of instruction and use the same student assessments as are used on the college campus. Colleges differ from one another, and so do concurrent enrollment programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And next.
Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Sharon Ornelius, who is a Milliken Award-winning teacher at Minneapolis' Edison High School.
Welcome, Ms. Ornelius, and congratulations.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Corman Ornelius. I'm a teacher at Edison High School in Minneapolis. I teach English as a second language. Before that, I've been at Patrick Henry High School for a number of years, and at that school, I taught the College and the School's Writing Studio course. I've been working this year to bring that course and other College and the School's courses to Edison so that our diverse students have more options for rigorous college coursework and course credit. At Edison, in the past, we only offered AP, and last year, only about 50% of our students who took AP even tried to take the test, and of those students, almost none of them passed. Which is pretty heartbreaking for how hard they've worked. If you notice, this is not only true in Minneapolis. We're not the only district that has diverse students. As you all know, diverse students are around the state now. If you look on your CAN handout on the back side, where it says credits earned and students served, the data, the nationwide College Board data for AP, shows that only 38% of tests taken by American Indian, Black, and Mexican American students were completed with scores of 3, 4, or 5, and now many colleges aren't even giving college credit for scores of 3. So then only 17% of those students actually may be earning college credit for those classes. We don't know exactly why that's the case, but we do know that it is, in general, our diverse students do not do as well on high-stakes, standardized type of tests. However, when I offered this course at Patrick Henry High School, out of about 55 students who took the course, only two students didn't get college credit for that course. And they were able to write rigorous college-level papers and to actually be assessed on the type of learning that they will be doing in college, not on a high-stakes standardized test.
Thank you very much, Representative Abney.
Madam Chair, we have two students with us today, Jenny Williams and Stefan Abney.
Stefan is first. Welcome and state your name.
Hello, I'm Chair, Representative. I'm Stefan Abney. I'm a junior at Washburn High School in South Minneapolis. I believe that the college in the schools option is really good for schools, just because, taking it, it's really given me, an idea of what college is going to be like, and it's just given me a different option than what I'm used to with classes. I'm used, the typical way of teaching, for instance, history is basically going section for section from your textbook, then taking a test on each section, then moving on. However, in my college in the schools class, it's more just grouping it all together, and it feels more like an actual college class. Also, on the matter of college in the schools versus AP or IB, in the college in the schools courses, you do obtain college credit instead of just the possibility of it by taking a test. In AP and IB, learn and cram basically all year, study for one big test at the end of the year, and then if you don't pass, you don't get any credit, and it's basically all your hard work really isn't shown. While in college and the schools, you're working hard, you're getting your high school credit as well as the college credit. So I just feel it's the better program, and yeah.
Ms. Williams, welcome and restate your name for the tape.
Okay. Madam Chair, President, I am Jenny Williams, and I'm also from Washburn High School in South Minneapolis. And I believe that CIS is better than AP or IB programs because it's kind of like PSEO, but it's a better option because you're still getting that college environment. You're being taught like you are in college because CIS is the same curriculum as the college at which we are getting it from. And you also get credits for it. You don't have to take a test at the end of the year, so you don't spend your whole year just studying for this one test where if you fail, you don't get the credit. And then also, some students can't get to college for PSEO programs, or they have jobs to get the after, and the timeline is limited for them. And also, our class is actually really diverse, and we don't just have the top academic performers in our class. We have all kinds of students, and everyone is doing very well. And I just think that it works so much better because, not everybody has the option of going to, PSEO, and not everybody has the ability to pass the AP exam because not everybody can just sit there and cram all this information and be expected to remember it and pass this test. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Abney, I think you brought two students that give us testimonial that it's a very nice program to have students like this. Representative Abney.
It is, and it's about the fit, which program fits which student. Batting cleanup, Principal Jeff Murphy from Shakopee High School.
Cleanup from Principal Murphy. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Jim Murphy, Madam Chair. I'm the principal of Shakopee High School. The legislature has really been pushing us, I'd say, for the last 15 years in the state to raise the rigor and standards for our students. The current catchphrase is that produce more students who are college ready. We have certainly made tremendous efforts in the Shakopee School District to do this. Last year, over 30% of our seniors graduated with college credits earned through the College and Schools program. In 2006-2007, our students earned 767 University of Minnesota credits. Last year, students earned 1,226 University of Minnesota credits. So we are making a real effort at this. At this time, we offer 10 college and school classes through the University of Minnesota and 2 through Normandale. We also offer 4 AP classes. We're proud to offer these. We found that AP and CIS courses are pretty much interchangeable as class options. There are some areas where we need to have the opportunity to have one or the other. For example, we have an AP statistics class that is not offered through the University of Minnesota and the CIS program. We also offer the writing lab class to our more talented ESL students, and that is not offered through AP. So we need the flexibility to be able to offer either AP or CIS. You might ask when we have both an AP and CIS option, which do we choose? I would say that the choice of our students, faculty, and parents is the college and schools option. The faculty really appreciates the ongoing support we receive from the University of Minnesota. The fact that the AP test comes down to, the AP college credit comes down to one test, as was stated by our students, is, I think, something that makes the CIS classes stand out above the others. College-level work is somewhat of a shock for high school students. And they like the idea that they can follow the typical college format, which is present in CIS classes, of one to two papers, two or three tests, and they can have a bad test, yet still come back and improve their performance. And for that reason, I think our students, faculty, and parents enjoy the CIS option. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Dabney.
Under time and under budget.
You are amazing. Look at that.
No, it's not me, it's them.
I'm sure that's true. There are four people signed up. I have Karen Ephraim, Marlis Peters, Melius, Holly Lewis, and Brian Poehler. And is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify? Hey, if the first two could come up to the table then, Dr. Ephraim and Marlis Peters Melius. Welcome, Representative, or Dr. Ephraim. You become one of us today. This is good for the potential promotion. But thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. Actually, Representative Dabney, we're here to support your bill. We agree and very much appreciate the effort to provide flexibility for students and family, and just really strongly concur with that. And I also would like to heartily agree with Ms. Henderson's testimony, particularly about IB with relation to its cost, its that it's not locally controlled, that it doesn't comport with the Minnesota standards that this body has worked for so many years to deal with. So to the extent that funding can be for either AP or concurrent enrollment, or even for Representative Garofalo's bill, which also provides flexibility and choice for parents and families, we would support that and ask that that if funding has to come from somewhere, that it comes from IB. Thank you very much. Thank you. Ms. Peters Melius, please restate your name for the tape and give us your testimony.
I'm Marlis Peters Melius, and I'm Executive Director of the International Baccalaureate Organization for Minnesota. We're IB World Schools. I do have a set of handouts if someone could pass them around. I'd appreciate it very much. I also brought along two other people to help present with me. So if I could call Holly Lewis and Brian Poehler up,
yes,
this time, I'd appreciate it.
Come forward, please. And then we have one more, Grace Kelleher as well, after you all. So the other two could come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm coming here as a representative of the Minnesota Association of IB World Schools and of the Minnesota Association of Advanced Placement Advisory Committee. My partner, Juliana Kotze, is on her way to Paris having a good time. So needless to say,
she's actually, no, the three of you have about 3 to 4 minutes.
Okay. But basically, first and foremost, I want to clarify that our organizations are not opposed to college enrollment programs or concurrent enrollment programs, and that we support a variety of options for students to earn credit and have college course experience in a high school. However, though we are opposed to including them in the same legislative piece, into the Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate legislation, because they're different for a variety of reasons. Their expectations are different, their processes are different, their standards are different. And I would like to just read briefly from the law itself, which is in Minnesota Statute 120B.1.3, Section 1, Subdivision 1. And it says, these programs, in addition to providing academic rigor, offer sound curricular design, accountability, comprehensive external assessment, feedback to students and teachers, and the opportunity for high school students to compete academically on a global level. And although I believe that, again, the current enrollment programs are excellent programs, they do not meet that particular piece of the law. They do not provide external assessments. All of the AP and IB assessments are developed by assessment divisions for IB and AP. The students worldwide must take the same comprehensive assessments, which are usually 3 to 5 hours, and they may include exams, papers, labs, orals, products of all kinds. And they receive feedback on those exams. So that's one of the components of the law, is feedback to the teachers and to the students. I believe that even though previous speakers addressed the issue of they don't always receive credits for AP and IB, one of the key reasons for taking an AP and an IB course has to do with college preparation in terms of the rigor of the work that they do and that they're involved with doing. And at this time, I would like to ask Holly Lewis to make a statement or two about the IB program.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Lewis. If you could restate your name and your title for the tape.
Thank you. Holly Lewis. I'm IB coordinator at Robbinsdale Cooper High School for the last 12 years, 4 years before that at Southwest High School in Minneapolis. In many ways, I could differentiate AP and IB from CEP, and I had all 7 of them, but I can't get the time. So I've chosen the authorization process, which helps to describe the fact, the coherence of the IB and the AP program, and the programmatic nature of them. In IB, there are 3 programs. All 3 programs, primary, secondary, middle school, and high school. There are 3 separate phases to the application. It can take 4 years. It culminates in a 2 to 3 day visit by the visiting team from IB, who could come from anywhere in the world. Authorization is granted when the school can show it is ready to deliver the curriculum in accordance with IB standards. Once that is done, you can't just coast. Every 5 years, they come back to you and ask you for a self-evaluation. We've just gone through that at Cooper. Alas, I did not bring one of these for each of you. But this is the scope of what we have to do to stay authorized with IB, which again underscores the coherence and the programmatic nature of it. I spent a year putting that together in dialogue and research with all parts of the IB community at Cooper High School. When we submitted it after a year, they came back and they gave us 6 areas to be addressed. 3 of them were systemic changes we needed to make, and we have done that. And now, a full year and a half after starting this process, we are maintaining our authorization. That's how serious IB is about what it is doing for kids. I could say lots more, but I will turn it over to Brian.
Thank you very much, and welcome, and please state your name and title.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm Brian Paler. I teach, I've taught AP European History at Eagan High School for 20 years. I've been on the Minnesota AP Advisory Council for the past 8 years, and currently am here as a legislative liaison. I'm not sure if I have about 20 seconds, but the main thing is that we are very much in agreement with IB. I think the framing of the argument is not so much, is this bad or good, IB versus concurrent enrollment, but again, it comes down to the nature of the law. The law, I've had the pleasure in the last 8 years of working with Democrats and Republicans on the AP Advisory Council, because we're nonpartisan, to talk about rigorous coursework for Minnesota students. One thing that's clearly come out is accountability and this external assessment. Easy to talk about, the AP exam and IB have that. And that's something that legislators have valued on both sides of the aisle, talking about how do we have students demonstrate that. In the law, there are lots of changes, including concurrent enrollment. When you get to the part about college credit, there's nothing there. And so that leads me to perhaps the intent of it was that, how do we grant college credit besides just you were in the class? Or maybe the intent of the authors was
that all students then should demonstrate their earning of college credit by taking either an IB, AP, or maybe another externally developed exam. The main thing is that accountability and external assessment have been crucial components to legislators over the years. And I hope that they've been included in law, and I hope that they will continue to be valued by legislators as you move forward considering this bill, and that you'll remove concurrent enrollment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, members, my name is Grace Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I'm here to thank Representative Dabney for his hard work on this area. We have a firm commitment to concurrent enrollment as well as AP and IB. But concurrent enrollment really reaches out to those places all across Minnesota and enables our students to succeed. I'm going to talk to you now as a mom. I had a mom who took a child who took part in concurrent enrollment, and I rarely try to speak about my kids. But he was able to graduate college in 3 years and was able to secure a place in the Carlson School of Management. So I know we try to talk about academic rigor, but certainly the local school board and the local community college and technical colleges around the state provide viable programs for kids to achieve. And the more opportunities we can give to kids, the better. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. That's the first time we've heard Ms. Kelleher talk about her children. She doesn't do that very often. Members, we have the time is now into the next hearing, but the one questioner that will be allowed is the representative who's cutting into his own hearing, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to take the note, I just for the maybe general information, I did write a college in the school of course to the University of Minnesota called Political Economy, and we were dealing with that same issue as being debated here, and we gave the high school credit and we gave a college credit if the students passed the AP examination in the spring. We had to earn at least a 3 before we give them any college credit, and that's how we dealt with that controversy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Dabney?
Madam Chair, I've carried by this point probably hundreds of pieces of legislation in my career here. 2007, when I first carried legislation around college and the schools, was a unique experience. I had parents in the hallways here. We call them lobbyists, but they're parents. Who don't lobby on education issues, stop me in the hall and say, I saw you on introductions, you had something about CIS. What are you doing there? And I tell them, and they say, you know, it's a great program. My kid was in the IB program, but because of his high school schedule, he couldn't get the diploma, but he wanted the rigor, so he's taking college and the school's classes now, and it's working great. My daughter is real active with the volleyball team. She doesn't want to do PSEO. She wants to remain with her friends in high school, but she wants and is capable of the academic rigor. College in the schools is what works for her. The passion that I've found out of parents, students, and teachers for this program is what has sold me on it for kids across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, and all the testifiers. Representative Benson, you're up. Representative Dabney's bill, House File 1702, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Dabney has at least one amendment to do himself. But first, if you could move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 751 for possible inclusion.
Benson moved House File 751 for possible inclusion. And which amendment is yours, if you could move that one?
I have the, looks like it's the A2-A090302.
Representative Benson moved the A090302 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he wants it. Could you just tell us briefly what this amendment does?
Yes, Madam Chair, and also I do have a small deletion on it provided to me from Education Minnesota. I met with President Durr. Very pleasant person, as you know, who's always cooperative. And so, if we could look at 1.9, if we were to put a period after the word rules and then cross everything out in 1.10,
Rick Dabney wishes to incorporate on line 1.9 of his amendment, put a period at the end of the sentence or the end of the line after rules and strike line 1.10 and renumber accordingly.
Thank you, that's
Representative Benson. So Representative Benson is putting this in here just going to be making it in the shape you want, and we'd be better off discussing the whole bill as is, or is there something here we...
And I will explain also, since we're attempting to sanitize everyone in every area of education, we had met with the president of Education Minnesota and his legal counsel, and he has some concerns that when we cleaned up the original bill and simplified it, that we'd maybe oversimplified, and so they were interested in putting some of that language back and clarifying a couple of items which we agreed to, and it is now in a condition that we think is adequate.
Any discussion of the amendment, or otherwise we're ready to vote. All in favor of A09-0302, say aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Benson.
And I just might add in that regard, Education Minnesota is taking position now that they are neutral, and hopefully they're indicating that they may in fact be enthusiastic supporters of this bill with these changes. But we'll have to wait and see. Never know, do we? Well, first of all, I'd just like to give a brief introduction, and many on this committee have already heard this bill, and to ingratiate myself with the committee chair and members, I will cut my comments real brief. And then, possibly, since Lisa Larson has done such a nice job giving an overview, maybe we can dispense of the overview, or at least reduce it to a very bare minimum unless people have some questions. So first of all, Madam Chair, I'd like to say, being a long a supporter of Minnesota Miracle Number 2, this bill is designed to add some more substance to the section having to do with reform. And I'd like to thank my co-authors, Representatives Bly, Daphne, Peterson, Riley, Downey, and Slocum, for their support of the bill. In a moment or two, I'll ask my testifiers, starting with Kurt Johnson, to kind of walk us through the bill briefly. The point of this bill is to deal with an issue that issues that have been revolving around the education world for years now, and is growing year by year, and those are the debates over accountability, choice, and competition. And House File 751 does address these issues, I think, in a unique and straightforward way, but it also deals with another fourth key area, which I've always found strange that it has never been addressed really adequately at all, and that is what we call the human capital component. That is the job of teaching itself, and what needs to be done to make the job better, more attractive, and the kind of employment that would retain great teachers. And to me, that is one of the key objectives of this bill. And just briefly, the bill is not a mandate. It's neither funded nor unfunded. We think there would be use to get it going, maybe through the federal innovation monies, through the federal stimulus program. But in this bill, there is no request for funding. It establishes a voluntary process, but it puts it in statute. Some schools are already doing this throughout the state. Others are reluctant, or staffs are not sure that if they engage themselves in all this activity that they will be supported, or that the programs will last over a long time. It gives permission then for teachers to propose new school innovations directly to the school boards while remaining employees of the district, remaining union members, and continuing to receive the negotiated benefit packages. And one should, I'd like to remind my fellow community members that I am a 35-year member of the AFL-CIO and of Education Minnesota, and I was a local president of Education Minnesota in Edina. And I'm not the kind of person, philosophically or any other way, who would try to undermine the union movement. So this bill does not deal with that at all. But it does spell out what autonomy means. And it also gives school districts something, and that is an opportunity to encourage those members of their faculties who are interested in doing something new and different to propose these changes. And at the same time, it protects the traditional school and all those who would like to say they are left harmless, kind of what we called before the split screen concept. Many people, many of my colleagues, appreciated and enjoyed traditional school setting and arrangement and did very well at it, and so did their students. Others of us found that we wanted some innovation opportunities, and it provides it as well. So with that introduction, I'd like to introduce Kurt Johnson, who will quickly go through the content of the bill.
Mr. Johnson, just to give you a sense of the time, the committee ends at 4:15, and we'll end on time because we have a hearing at 5:30 in Farmington. And so we do have an amendment, and we have a public member who wishes to testify on that. So at about 7 or 8 after, we're going to go to the amendment, no matter what. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We do recognize the need to convert this to the two-minute drill, so we'll try to do that.
Sorry about that. We're glad we had the policy hearing.
My name is Kurt Johnson. I'm the managing partner of Education Evolving, and it's been our pleasure to be of assistance to Representative Benson in preparing this bill. Let me, without repeating what he's already said quite adequately, just try to reinforce that, in our judgment, this is one of those opportunities for the legislature to do serious policy architecture. This may be seen later as the most significant change in the policy theme for schools since 1991 in the charter law. As Representative Benson said, this bill does not order anybody to do anything. It's a monument to voluntarism. It's an opportunity bill. We think it's an opportunity for school boards to create schools that can enjoy the same flexibility as those in the charter sector do. It's an opportunity for willing parents and teachers to create the kinds of schools they think we need to succeed with the kids we are now losing. It's an opportunity, maybe most importantly, for teachers, many of whom leave the profession, not so much for inadequate salary, but because they don't think it's very fulfilling, and they would like to be professionals like other professionals are. And most of all, for parents and kids who clearly need a wider variety of learning strategies, since one standard thing never has fit all kids. This is not new in the sense that there are places around the country, mostly cities, that are trying to start this new schools movement all the way from Boston in the east to Los Angeles in the west. But so far, no state has made this a state policy, and that is really the opportunity for Minnesota. So if it's all right, Madam Chair, I will try to do the one-minute version of what's in each subdivision. Subdivision 1 simply spells out that the superintendents and school boards can request proposals for the kinds of schools they want to see created, and that any group of licensed professionals and parents can suggest a new school. This builds on the changes you made in the site space management statute in 2005. It specifies how any variations in the collective bargaining contracts can be recorded in memorandum of understanding. It calls for an agreement to be forged between the district board and this new school through a site governing council, and makes clear what the roles and responsibilities are. And that's in subdivision 2 then, which spells out, we hope as clearly as possible, the authority of those proposing to run the new school. It means they can determine their own leadership model, determine how to spend the money, decide on the learning model the school will use, and even set policies ranging from higher graduation requirements if they wanted to length of school day and school year, and the manner in which teacher and other staff are selected. It is clear that on teacher selection, the school will draw from available and willing teachers within the district. And as Representative Benson said, the district remains the legal employer of all staff. Teachers retain their rights to union membership and benefits. Subdivision 3 tries to spell out the main sources of revenue and assures that they arrive in proportion to the number of students that are generating that revenue. And it addresses the issue of the negotiated administrative fee that the district may charge for facilities maintenance, special education, and other overhead costs. Subdivision 4. In addition to the autonomy spelled out within the district, this subdivision makes it clear that the new schools created under this section are exempt from, as well as subject to, the same laws as specified in the statutes governing chartered schools. Subdivision 5 is the first attempt to spell out what performance standards might be, if these schools are not going to be judged, they're not going to be told what to do and how to do it, but judged on the results, then what results? It contemplates that these agreements that will be forged will set forth a way of judging student achievement and criteria to follow if student achievement is not adequate. The last provision specifies the conditions for terminating agreement between a district and a school and says it must be for good cause, having to do with violations of law, or failure to live up to the provisions of the agreement, and the termination for any other reason would trigger the right of the school to convert to charter status.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hermanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rose Hermanson. I'm with the Minneapolis Teachers. I'm here speaking on behalf of our President, Lynn Nordgren, who cannot be here today, but feels quite passionately about this bill, and some of you heard her testimony in full committee. I want to make just three quick, brief points. This bill encourages teachers to use the professional expertise to the fullest extent to design a learning environment that works for students. And they are willing to be held accountable. They know it works in many instances. They just want an opportunity to go forward with these ideas. Number two, it provides an opportunity and supports innovation. There is so much research out there right now, and many times we do not find ways to allow that research to reach the classroom. I think this is one that will help us bring it into the classroom, and we need to find ways to do this. Number three, it is a collaborative approach. It involves parents, teachers, and the district in a partnership. It's not mandated. It's done within a structure that makes us work together as partners. We ask for your support, and we do support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for those of us like myself with a lot of history in this place, this is a big full circle to have Mr. Johnson and Ms. Hermanson at the same table for the same bill. Representative Ward has an amendment, and he got in with his 24-hour rule, the A1 amendment. He is now changing it to the A2 amendment, and we could go through the rigmarole of substituting A2 into A1, but with the committee's indulgence, since the A1 made the deadline, does anyone have a problem, since they are the same amendment, just with some details worked out, with Representative Ward introducing the A2 amendment instead? Hearing none, Representative Ward, if you want to, your A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The two amendments...
And Mr. Ward, if you could move your amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll move H0751A2.
The amendment is moved. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the purpose of the amendment, Madam Chair and members, is just to, applaud Representative Benson's efforts here. And all of the other folks in the potential school... will be licensed, and I just think that the leader of the, if there's a principal hired before this school, as the amendment states, if a self-governed school created under section is supervised by a principal, that principal must be licensed consistent with the sections referred to, for a couple reasons. For licensed principals are able to do some background checks, rely on code of ethics, and training also, purposes. Everyone else is going to need to be licensed, and I just think that the leader of the potential school also needs to be licensed. So I offer this amendment, and Representative Benson and I have talked about this. I know that the other, Mr. Johnson and others have talked about this as well, and I think Lisa Larson has actually done the work on this amendment, so we know that if Lisa did it, it's probably accurate and correct. So I offer this as a potential amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We have Roger Aronson, if you could come down, but first we'll hear from either Representative Benson or either of his two testifiers. Representative Benson.
Well, Madam Chair, we have looked at this changed amendment. It was not quite the one that I had thought. Ms. Aronson had told me about it. I've seen it a couple minutes before committee today. But this second and changed amendment is fine with us.
Good. Mr. Aronson.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate working with Representative Benson on this. As you might guess, we think licensure is very important. We appreciate Representative Ward's taking this for us. The committee's indulgence, and I have to say that Ms. Larson's work in turning something around on a dime is obviously amazing.
Thank you. We appreciate things being worked out, and so we can get to questions. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor? I mean, all opposed. The amendment is adopted. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was answered with the Representative Board amendment.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two issues. One is the probationary teachers. If you have probationary teachers hired for this sort of charter school within the school, would they fall under the same provision as other probationary teachers in the school district and be subject to be let go if there's a reduction in force? And the second question has to do with, you know, the concept that Mr. Johnson was addressing about, you know, the maintenance and so forth. Should these, I'll cite Anoka Hennepin district, we're going to be closing schools, we're going to be closing, shutting down buildings. If we have one of these schools start in one of those buildings, should they not be eligible for the lease funding that charter schools receive?
Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Newton, I'll attempt to answer the first one. I'm not sure about the lease aid question, but the teachers in the self-governed school and the school district are all under the same contract, and all are under the continuing contract laws. And it's the continuing contract laws that determine the layoff and recall procedures. Secondarily, there's a memorandum of understanding between the school district and the applicable unions as they develop these schools. So if there's any exception to that, that would have to be known up front as part of the agreement that would be approved by the board and by the union.
Anyone, did that answer all your questions, or do you still want to know about the lease?
What half?
Anyone about the lease?
Madam Chair, the second part of the answer. First of all, Representative Newton, we think this is going to be such a great success that they'll be opening schools, not closing them. But to try to answer your question,
we have buildings, Mr.
Representative Benson, we have a question after this one.
Okay, these schools being established by parents and teachers who see an opportunity to provide a new educational experience, and we think what we'll do is allow the public schools to attract back students that they are presently losing to other organizations. So,
follow up briefly, Madam Chair. Is
Representative Newton?
I just think that that these schools would be as a new charter school that they'd be entitled to that lease funding that could come back to the school district, because by and large those buildings were bought by bonds and now they're going to be sitting empty.
Okay. Well, I have the fiscal staff
you may be right on
that. Lease aid question. Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom?
Yes,
Mr. Crow.
And members, it's not a charter school, it wouldn't qualify for lease aid.
So that took care of that. Representative Holcomb.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, in where I teach, we have a program called TOSA, Teacher on Special Assignment, and oftentimes teachers assume a principal's role, obviously without all the legal ramifications that Representative Ward talked about, but it's a way to extend their professionalism and their
right.
expertise. And to let a teacher professionally decide whether they want to go into administration or not.
Right.
Would a TOSA be allowed to run a school?
Yes.
In this proposal?
Yes, it would. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Slocum, the reason we had a problem with the first wording of the Ward Amendment was it seemed to indicate that that these schools would have to have a principal. And our schools may have principals, may hire them. But there are several schools in the state right now in existence, at least six or so, that do not have principals, and the teachers in that school carry on a number of the responsibilities and duties that we usually would assign to a principal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good, because I think that's a great way for teachers to extend their practice.
This is an opportunity for teachers to become true professionals, and it's one of the main objectives that I have. We have to get away from the hierarchical factory model. It doesn't work anymore.
Any closing statement from anyone up there, or are we ready to vote? Or not vote, we're just laying the bill over. Never mind. Any closing statement?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate the time you've given us so late in this session,
And before I let you have your closing statement, I forgot to ask for testimony. Mr. Grathwall, is there anyone else?
Oh.
Mr. Grathwall.
Madam Chair, Jim Grathwall, members of the committee representing Minneapolis Public Schools, please support the bill.
Thank you for that concise testimony. That's
we have one
everything
more.
We need to know. Rep. Benson, I guess we're out of time for your closing statement. Mr. Bartholdi.
Yeah.
We're really out of time. You don't have any more to say. Mr. Bartholdi, you are the closing statement, and you've got about 30 seconds.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we're very much in support of this. Hope you would adopt it. It's a wonderful opportunity.
This is a full circle bill, I have to say. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, and House File, whatever this is, 751 is laid over for possible inclusion. The meeting's adjourned. I hope to see you all in Farmington.
Okay. I call the meeting to order. I'm Mindy Greiling. I'm the chair of the Education Finance Committee, and we're so pleased to be here and to have such a great crowd. And I'm saying that I am just going to start the meeting, and then I will turn it over to my co-chair for the evening and your own legislator, Representative Pat Garofalo. We had a lot of hearings on education over the interim, and we haven't had one for quite a while. And we're very interested in this one because Representative Garofalo tells us that this is a little bit different in terms of the education funding problems of some of the districts that we have visited. So we are all ears. The legislative process is a dynamic process, and we have changed bills like the new Minnesota Miracle House File 2 in details after we have been in districts that know about the specific problems that we're trying to address in different parts of the bill. So I will just say I'm lucky I don't have to go this far as Representative Buffalo does to get to my home. I'm 10 minutes north of the Capitol. I live in Roseville and also represent Lauderdale and St. Anthony Village. And Representative Garofalo is our lead Republican on the committee, and he always keeps us entertained, but he also is well-informed and very hardworking. And I'll now turn it over to him.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate me to take this from you. That's so nice. Wow. thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity you've granted Farmington, Lakeville, and Randolph School Districts and surrounding communities for hosting this hearing. I do know that it's sort of a rare event, and when the majority party holds an event in a minority party district, I really do appreciate it. But before we begin, I'd like to have Dr. Meeks just kind of do the welcome, and I just have some opening remarks for everybody before we begin to take our testimony. So, Dr. Meeks.
Thank you, Representative Rockwell and Representative Riley. Certainly extend a warm welcome on this chilly afternoon to your committee, and thank you for providing this opportunity to our school districts in the local area. We really appreciate the time that we're going to take in the next hour and a half to hear a little bit about what our school districts are about and some of the concerns and challenges and some of the good things that are going on in our district as well. So welcome, and we're looking forward to the next 90 minutes or so. Just to invite some of our recognition of board members that I'm seeing, the great turnout. I'm glad Jared wants to answer this.
I'd like to recognize a couple of our board members that I see in the crowd right now. We have Bob Heeman, who's our board chair, and Julie Singwald, who is a board treasurer. Are there any of our other board members here at this point? Not that I see. Representing the Lakeville School District is Superintendent Gary Amoroso. And I'll have Gary introduce his board members here in just a second. And then we have Glenn Woodhouse representing the Randolph School District. So, Gary, you want to introduce your board members?
The board chair will introduce our board.
Hi, I'm Judy Kelleher, chair of the Lakeville School Board. And we have board member Michelle Volk, board member Roz Peterson, board member Kathy Lewis, board member Jim Skelly, and board member Bob Erickson here today.
Glenn, if there's anyone else, so anyone else from Randolph. All right. With that, we'll turn it back over to you. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Meeks. And just a couple of housekeeping measures. Number one, there are two different types of comment cards if you're interested. If you wish to testify after the presentations from the two school districts, there is a green card you can fill out. And I believe staff has those around somewhere near, and I'll just show us to everybody. They have them back there that if you could walk them around to people who are interested in filling them out. If you prefer to offer your opinions, if you don't want to get up and talk, you can fill out one of these white comment cards, and those are also available. And I did want to mention a couple of other points. One is that we are streaming this event live, or we aren't, but it's being streamed live on the Internet, the local This Week paper at thisweeklive.com, I believe, is the website, is actually streaming the event, so thank you very much for that. And then in addition, you'll notice that there are some committees that are meeting late today, so members will be coming in later on as the committee gets started. So, Representative Greiling, if it's okay, we'll hold off maybe on the member introductions until a little bit later when other members show up. So, we'll begin with the presentation, and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we know who you are. But before we begin, I have to tell you a quick story, Representative Greiling. I'm sorry, but in Farmington, we determine when schools are closed for snow, excessive snow, in a unique fashion. There's a rumor around Farmington that Dr. Meeks has a rule that if he can drive to school, then the buses can drive to school. And I learned from my seventh grade son that, in fact, Dr. Meeks has a 4x4 truck with a plow on it. That's why we never cancel school. So welcome to the committee, and again, please state your names for the tape.
Brad Meeks, superintendent of the Farmington Area Public Schools.
Christine Weymouth, assistant superintendent, Farmington Schools.
I'm Jeff Priest, the director of finance for the school district.
All right. Well, again, thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about our school district this evening. What we've prepared for you is just a brief overview of our school district. We'll break it down in three parts. I'll just give a general overview of our district. Dr. Weymouth will talk about some of the teaching and learning activities that are going on. And then Mr. Priest will talk about some of the financial status of our district. But for those of you that haven't been here before, our school district serves the cities of Farmington and Lakeville, and also serves townships of Eureka, Castle Rock, and Empire. As you're aware, this has been a growing district for quite some time. We're continuing to grow, although we've slowed down a little bit the last few years, so we're growing about 2% per year. We do have a new high school that will be opening this fall, scheduled to be completed here within a couple of months. It will be a 912 building. The building that you're in this evening will be converted into a 6-8 middle school, and there will be some work commencing on that this summer as well. So we've had quite a busy year in our district with grade reconfigurations and new boundaries and renaming of buildings and all the construction projects that go with it, and I think that are all reflective of the growth that we've been experiencing in Farmington for quite some time. If you turn to page 2, you will see the enrollment projections that goes out to 2010 and 11. I started in the Farmington district in 2003, where we had around 5,300 students, and this fall we had about 6,300. So we've added 1,000 students to our district in the last 5-plus years, and we haven't added any buildings, but we're looking forward to that relief coming this fall. And you can see where that growth is. We're looking at continuing to increase over time. Also coming with that growth, we're also experiencing changing demographics, which are very typical, I think, in metro area schools. About 12% of our students are students of color, which is up from more than double, 5.6% in 2002-2003. We serve about 239 students with limited English proficiency, which is up from 200 in 2005-06. Again, when I started in the district in 2003, we had two ELL teachers. Now we have six in our district. And of those 239 students, there are 24 languages that are spoken with those We have about 13% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch, which is up from 8% from just a few years ago. Dr. Wayman.
Well, Dr. Meeks told me today that I needed to speak in front of the committee, and so I wore my tiger, Huntington tiger. I apologize for that. Ahead of time, but we are delighted to be the Farmington Tigers. Wakefield's growing demographics and our growing school district, of course, our teaching and learning and the investments that we have placed in our teaching and learning throughout the district is really a high point for the district. We believe that in collaboration with all staff, district-wide staff, educational assistants, everyone involved with students in the district are all geared toward a common mission, and that is improvement of student achievement. We believe we have strong staff. We have equally strong and qualified and dedicated principals, all of these people. We continue to train in instructional skills that we believe are supported and guided by a strong teaching and learning district office staff that works with teachers, principals, and, of course, students and parents. We are committed to what we are calling a professional learning community, and that is that our teachers find time during the day to do those professional things that support and strengthen student learning in the classroom. And so one of our main missions through our strategic plan and our efforts really involves teacher development. And if you are involved in education at all, specifically, you know that teacher training and teacher development is really one of the most important things that we do as a school district. We are dedicated and committed to embedding our professional development in the work that we do each day, and one of the most important things that we are doing right now is we are full-scale throughout our district really engaging in deep conversation and training in the area of balanced literacy, and that is teaching our students the very best way that we can in the area of reading and writing and language arts. We know that those are the foundations for learning, and we believe it, and we've seen evidence of it, and hopefully our scores continue and our work in that area will continue in years to come. Also, we are committed to many things. I think just to name a few, we're highly involved and want to continue to be involved in looking at best practice in the area of standards-based grading, and that means telling parents the most important information and the most accurate information we can around how their students are performing according to state standards. So we will be and are engaged in that type of work. We're looking at how to develop better assessments in the classroom that tell us more about what students know and are able to do. We're very dedicated to our math curriculum and teaching our teachers, all of our teachers, but a specific emphasis on some of our elementary teachers about how to do math instruction well. We are highly engaged in information technology integration. We value the work that we do in curriculum review each year and coaching in the classroom where teachers work together toward coaching each other in their craft. And then finally, we have as a district, many districts in the state, been involved in Farmington Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System, the TUCOMP program. And we work in great collaboration with our teachers in improving the type of training that they do, the things that I just mentioned, everything in the area of assessment, instruction, and curriculum. We're highly involved through that program in peer coaching, and that is master teachers working critically with some of our newer staff. We're also focusing on instructional facilitators in the buildings, that is those people who are especially gifted in that area, working with other teachers in the classroom and instructional improvements. We are also preparing what we call professional improvement plans, though critically looking at how do we take individual schools' student information around our student achievement and pushing that harder so that our students excel to the very best that they can. And finally, I think we're challenged by the notion that we want to continue that work that the QCOMP program is doing and continue the work that we're doing. And, of course, the QCOMP program has assisted us with that, but to continue the good work that we're doing in the area of student achievement. And you can see that we are a part, the final graph that's on page 4, we are a part of the NWEA assessment, which is curriculum-based achievement assessment for students, and tells us that our students continue to grow according to national and state standards, and that, and also tells us hopefully where we need to improve. Thank you.
Now, if we continue on and some financial information regarding the district, if we look at that first chart, the expenditures per student, I think what that reflects and heard earlier that there probably are some unique things here with this district that you maybe haven't heard when you visited some other districts. But I think this kind of reflects a low spending in growing school districts. So as you can, if we look at from the years 2004 through 2007, where we've got state average figures, you can see that with the general fund, we're about $1,500 less than state average. And I guess that corresponds with all of our kind of operating funds. And then it's a different story when we look at our building construction and debt service, and you can see that because of the growth, we are, in fact, as Dr. Meeks mentioned, we're constructing a new high school right now that will open next fall. So we have a fair amount of debt, the building construction taking place now, and then debt service payments on bonds. And then that kind of, I think, flows into the next chart where we look at the debt equalization. So as we are kind of a high debt district, it's probably an area that's driving our cash levy is the debt service fund. We have about $280 million in bonded debt. And so we look at the equalization aid and kind of what's happened with that, where we haven't seen any changes to the equalized factor that's set at about $8,000. So you can kind of see the impact to us, and then that can translate over to what happens with our with the district's tax levy. So in 2007, actually I think these are pay 06, 2007-2008 school year, $2.6 million in debt equalization aid. And as we see with the tax levy that we set last December, that's down to $2 million. So there's no change as our tax capacity grows. Student growth doesn't quite keep up with that. The way the formula works, we're receiving less and less debt equalization aid, and of course that's driving the tax rate. Now when that happens, it's probably a little harder here to pass an operating referendum, and that's reflected then on that previous chart where we're kind of low spending when you look at our operating funds. And then just to continue on, look at some of the, we're in a position, if our assumptions hold true, what we've taken at school board is that we're expecting no increase in state aid. And then we've done a number of things over the years just to kind of keep us out of that big cut mode. We're hearing a lot of other school districts are looking at for next year. Health insurance, we kind of changed our plan, running with a high deductible plan and operating with some expenditures underneath that. We're going to save about $650,000 this year alone in our health insurance. So I think I just want to say we do quite well without a mandatory statewide health insurance program. I think we're seems to be working out okay. And just some of our other, bidding out some of our other insurance packages, as you can see the savings there. And some reductions, I think increasing efficiencies, looking at anytime somebody leaves, retired, look at can we do some things differently. And I think that's reflected some of the business office staff reorganization, renegotiated, some of our property casualty insurance programs. We're members of the C program. We just got our second quarter report, so we're new in the program this year. First year, but our second quarter savings, I think that was for November, December, and January, $26,000 in utility savings. So overall, $963,000 in savings. And then if we look at, I guess, our general fund revenue sources, when you're a district with a lower referendum. Actually, we're at about $180 per student past a referendum fall of 2007. So we're at $600 on our operating referendum, but still below state average. And you can, and I think this chart here kind of shows our dependence on state aid. About 90% of our total revenue in the general fund. So where that funding formula goes or doesn't go has a big impact on the school district. And then just to, I'm sure you hear about all the mandates, but the impact to this district, staff development, 2% of the funding formula, about $750,000 each year that we set aside for staff development. We look at special education. You know, again, can the Fed step up, fund 40% in the district's cross subsidy for, I think this is a 2007-2008 number, $2.5 million. And I just wanted to count, you know, as we're kind of looking at the different budget proposals and we hear about the accounting shifts and, you know, the property tax shift. So a lot of times we hear that, well, that's revenue neutral. It's probably not when we look at the fact that we may have to go out and borrow some cash to make our payments. Or we may dip into our fund balance, which isn't huge, but obviously we use that for cash flow. So if we look at one of the proposals to, I think, take the stage from 90 to 80, and then increase again the old tax shift, it could have an impact. We're estimating the impact to be anywhere between $26 and $33 per student, or $225,000. So, not quite revenue neutral. That obviously does have has an impact on us. And then, right now we're in the process. We haven't, with our budget assumptions, really taken into account any of the stimulus dollars. We're trying to figure out how we're going to utilize those dollars. I guess the stabilization dollars could be become part of the replace some of the general ed funding. So we're just kind of sitting back and waiting to see, you know, just exactly what will happen with those federal dollars. And we have concerns with I guess the kind of the 2-year window. What happens after that? Special education maintenance of effort concerns we have there. So. That's kind of a quick overview of the district's financial status.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you supplying the information. And you brought up in your testimony one of the discussion points in the community is that as you have some parents who say, well, look at our classroom spending compared to others neighboring school districts, it's actually lower. And then you have other parents who say, well, wait, our property taxes that we pay to the school district are actually higher than the neighboring school districts. And as we know, both those parents are right. It ties into the lack of commercial industrial property in the school district and relative to other communities. So thank you very much. I appreciate your guys' your testimony and for hosting us here today.
Thank you.
Dr. Amoroso, as you make your way down, I will take a minute here just to allow the members of the committee to introduce themselves to you. And we will begin on my left with Representative Benson.
You have to stop those playful aspersions. Actually, we get along quite well. I'm Representative John Benson. I'm in my second term, serving from the Minnetonka and Plymouth area. And I was just pleasantly surprised to meet your assistant superintendent, Christine Weymouth. She and I were colleagues when I was a classroom teacher for many, many years in Edina schools. So it was fun meeting her again today.
Good evening. My name is Denise Dietrich. I represent House District 27A, which includes a northern suburb of Champlin and a portion of Coon Rapids.
And I'm Representative Tom Tilbury, and I represent the areas of Fridley, Moundsview, Spring Lake Park, and a portion of Blaine. And I felt like I walked into a great place just here, being very welcomed in. And now I found out why. It's like Tigers, Fridley Tigers. Go Tigers.
I'm Representative Bob Detmer. I represent the Forest Lake area, just northern Washington County and eastern Anoka County. And driving over here, I just love the farmland. I grew up on a dairy farm down in Rice County, so it's neat seeing all that farmland out there. So good to be here.
Good evening. My name is Carlos Mariani Rosa. I represent District 65B, which is basically the central part of St. Paul. I actually have the capital that sits in my district, and the Mississippi River goes right through the middle of my district. It's a real pleasure to be here. And although I am to the left of Representative Raffalo, I'm not as far left as Representative Raffalo. I'm more of a centrist than it would appear. I chair the K-12 Policy Committee as well. Wow. It's a pleasure to be here.
So do I.
Well, thank you. My name is Representative John Ward, and Representative Groffel kept telling us that the sun shines all the time in Farmington, and lo and behold, we came in here and it was shining, so it's awesome to be here. I represent District 12A, Brainerd, Baxter, Crosby, Arrington, Nisswa, God's country where y'all come in the summer. And we want you to keep coming. So I was a teacher and coach for 34 years, and education is a passion of mine and a priority of mine. So thank you all for being here tonight and showing your passion and your commitment to education as well.
Hi, my name is Representative Paul Anderson, and I too enjoyed coming down with Representative Garofalo to see this open country because I am a farmer. I live up in the area of Glenwood, Starbuck, in Polk County, if maybe some of you have heard of that. And I talked to my wife on the way down. We got 8 inches of heavy, wet snow today, so I hope she gets the snowblower going and gets the driveway blown out. I like to tell folks we have a little slower lifestyle back up on the farm. We have a mile-long driveway, and compared to down here, a little bit more laid-back style. It takes us about an hour and a half back home to watch the TV program 60 Minutes.
Hi, I'm Representative Carol McFarland. I represent 53B, which is the White Bear Lake area, both White Bear and Mountain View school districts, and I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. I'm Linda Slocum, and I represent District 63B, which is East Richfield, East and Central Bloomington, Mall of America, the airport. And I'm a school teacher. I teach 7th and 8th graders things they don't want to know in Minneapolis. What thing else do I do?
I'm Representative Robin Brown. I serve District 27A, which is the Albert Lea area. That's right where I-35 and 90 cross. I also have another 21 small cities and towns in that area, right next to the border of Iowa.
Well, and my name is Pat. I'm from Farmington. So, Dr. Amoroso, and glad with your testimony.
Please state your name for the tape.
Gary Amoroso, Superintendent, Lakeville Area Public Schools.
Judy Kelleher, Chair of Lakeville Schools.
I want to thank Chair Greiling and Representative Groffel for providing us with this opportunity to share some thoughts with you regarding the Lakeville Area Public Schools. I do need to state that there are two additional cats in town, the Lakeville North Panthers and the Lakeville South Cougars. So we share that with our colleagues to the east with Farmington. What we would like to do tonight is just share a little bit about our school system to give you a little bit of a flavor of who we are. We're going to focus a little bit on the student achievement gains that we've experienced over the last 6 or 7 years. Talk a little bit about our financial situation, and then Chair Kelleher is going to talk a little bit about some thoughts for the future. Again, we're very grateful for this opportunity to share some thoughts with you. The Lakeville Area Public Schools is the 10th largest school district in the state of Minnesota. We have approximately 11,150 students in our school district. Up until the last year or two, we were growing. We were growing by 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 kids over the last decade prior to those last 2 years. And the economy with the housing market has had a significant impact on our school system. We're at the point now where we're projecting about a 22 student increase next year, and then we're actually currently projecting a decrease in enrollment for the 2010-2011 school year, something that when I came to Lakeville in July of 2001, never thought we would ever experience. And so we're very fortunate that we had those growth for many years because of how our funding formula works. That provided us with some additional dollars, but we're now getting to the point, as many of our colleagues are throughout the state, that we're going to be a flat district, if not maybe a very small decrease in district, which will have a significant impact on the type of funding that we receive and, quite frankly, then the programs that we'll be able to offer. We serve students in the city of Lakeville, the city of Elk and New Market, a very small portion of Burnsville, townships of Eureka and Credit River. And we're very proud of the partnerships that we have with all of those different municipalities in doing our best to serve children. In terms of demographics, a little bit of what you heard from our colleagues in Farmington. When I came to the school district in 2001, we had approximately 2% students of color in our district. This year we have approximately 12% students of color in our district. We have 33 languages now spoken within our school district. When you compare it to a Minneapolis or St. Paul, it doesn't seem very significant. But when you look at Lakeville and what that means in terms of how we need to ramp up how we serve children, how we need to do additional staff development with our staff so that we can provide them with the skills necessary to work with all of our children, that also creates some challenges. I'd just like to share a few thoughts with you regarding the achievement levels of our system. And it's something that we're very, very proud of, is the achievement of the students within ISD 194. And we believe that that achievement goes back to the vision that is established by our school board through our strategic plan. We have a strategic planning process. It's a living process. It's a process that is updated. And it's a process that focuses on students, because that is, of course, our priority. We have an outstanding professional staff and support staff of approximately 1,500 individuals that work on a day-to-day basis with our students. But what really, I think, sets us apart from many districts is the outstanding support that we gain from our community. And I'm not just talking about our parents that support, but I'm talking about our community as a whole. We have a partnership with our Chamber of Commerce that is unlike any I've seen in my 34 years in education. They're actively involved in working within our schools, trying to help our students gain experiences that will help them in their futures. And so we just have a wonderfully supportive community, and that's why the type of achievement levels that I'm about to describe to you occur. When you look at our achievement levels, there's many ways to measure achievements, but I'd like to give you a few of those different barometers that we utilize to help us get a sense of how our students are growing from year to year. First barometer that we'll share with you is our friends, the MCA2s. And we all love the MCA2s. It does provide us with information. And the information that it provides us with is how our students doing in meeting or exceeding the expectations in math and in reading. Last year, we were very pleased to report that 72% of our students either exceeded or met the guidelines in the area of math, and 81% of our students either met or exceeded the guidelines in reading. What that did for us was put us in the upper quartile for the 7-county metro district in terms of the largest 10 districts in student enrollments in the state of Minnesota. That was the highest level of students meeting or exceeding the standards. And in terms of the largest 15 school districts in the state of Minnesota by enrollment, we tied for first in terms of the percent of students, something we're very, very proud of. Another way to look at how your students are doing is the ACT. As all of us know, the ACT is that test that helps you identify the preparedness for students in college. And we have a significant percent of our students that take the ACT. So we're not dealing with 50 or 60% of our students, but we're probably dealing with 70 to 80% or more of our students that take the ACT. And one of the things that we're very, very proud of is that over the course of the last 7 years, we've gone from a composite score of 22.1 in Lakeville to this year having a composite score of 23.6. And that has been a trend that we've seen go up over the course of those years. Last year was the first year we hit 23. And so the immediate conversation we had was, how do we keep growing? How do we keep moving to that next level? And we're very proud to report that this year we were at 23.6. When the state average is 22.6, and nationally the average is 21.1. One of the other ways that we measure achievement and success of our students is looking at our graduation rate. What percent of our students are walking out the door prepared for that next point in their life, whether it be going to a four-year college, whether it be going to a two-year college, whether it be going to a technical school, the world of work, the military, whatever they choose to do, we need to make sure that they're prepared to be successful. And one of the things that we're very, very proud of is that during the 2000-2001 school year, we had a graduation rate of 89.72%, something that nobody in Lakeville was satisfied with. And I'm very pleased to report that over the course of those last 7 years, on a yearly basis, we've seen growth to the point that this past, the latest year that MDE has on file for the 06-07 school year, we have 98.41% of our students graduating. And that's something that, again, has not happened overnight. It literally has taken us these years to grow that rate. And again, it goes back to the outstanding staff we have working in collaboration with our community. It's truly a joint effort to work on behalf of our children. One of the things that we're very, very proud of is our advanced placement program. Advanced placement courses are courses that provide students an opportunity not only to grow academically, but if they're successful on a post-course test, they can earn college credit. And I'll tell you, the parents like when the kids earn college credit and they get a step up into the world of college. My stepdaughter is going to walk out of high school next year and have one full year of college in the books. That's a good thing.
Dad likes that too.
Yeah, parents like that, absolutely. And what we're proud to share is that 7 years ago we had 4 AP courses in the Lakeville Area Public Schools. Our board made a commitment to grow that program and support that program. We now have 22 or 23 advanced placement courses. And again, it's just something very powerful for our students. Other thing we're very proud of is not only do we offer the courses, but how many of the students actually gain the college credit? The state average last year was 63% of the tests taken qualified for college credit. Last year in Lakeville, we had 78% of the students that took the individual test, 70% of those tests qualified for college credit. From 6 years ago, we have gone up 6 times the number of students and the number of tests that are being taken. So we've made it clear that the AP courses are not just for students that are the high flyers, quote-unquote, or the gifted and talented, quote-unquote, but they're for all children. Because we believe all children have a strength and all have the abilities to succeed and to grow. Very quickly, last measure of growth that I'd like to share with you is the NWEA. You've heard about the NWEA already tonight. We have an awful lot of value in our NWEA. And once again, the NWEA is conducted in Lakeville. It's a commitment by our school board. This costs dollars. NWEA costs dollars in order to implement. And we implemented the process in grades 2 through 8 over a 3-year period of time. Full implementation has now begun, and we provide our students with the opportunity to take the tests in grades 2 through 8 in fall. We just completed our winter window about a month ago, and we're very, very proud to report, and our school board received this report last week, but across the board, in grades 2 through 8, Lakeville students outperformed the winter national norms in the reading and the math, and even what we're more proud of is that the student growth, not just that they grew, but that the predicted growth outperformed the national norm at each and every grade level. So again, something we're very, very proud of, and it's a tribute to our staff and to our community. One of the things that we're also proud of in our community is that we do this with a less than average funding in terms of what we expend on students. According to the Minnesota Department of Education for the 2006-2007 school year, the average expenditure per pupil was approximately $8,920. That year, Lakeville spent approximately $8,341. So we were approximately $600 below the state average on per pupil expenditure, but yet we had some outstanding results. And so while we won't say there's a correlation dollar for dollar in achievement with resources, we still believe it's necessary to have the resources in order to work with children. And very briefly, you heard a little bit about stimulus. Our stimulus opportunities will probably be in the areas of special ed. The preliminary runs show that we will not receive any additional dollars in Title I from the stimulus, but that it looks as though we are going to receive some dollars in terms of the special education. The warnings that you heard earlier tonight are the warnings that we've been given by our friends at MDE, as well as from the state, that we need to be careful that when those dollars come through, we very clearly understand one-time dollars, and people are making it very clear, do not expend those dollars on ongoing costs. So whatever you can determine to be one-time costs, those are the kind of things you can look at. The other thing that we're pleased about is that up to 50% of the available dollars we're hearing can be used to supplement the cross subsidy within what's coming out of our general fund. In my hand, I'm holding $17 million worth of budget adjustments that have been made in our school district the last 7 years. Two of the years were traumatic. 2 years ago, we adjusted $7.2 million. We just completed a process on February 10th, a very challenging process for our school board, where they adjusted our budget for next year by $6 million. And I will share with you that the adjustments for those adjustments for next year was that our funding would be held flat. Not that we would receive any additional funding, but also that we will not lose any funding. And so, while I know you are facing some very challenging times, and we appreciate that, and we understand that, we're hoping that as much as humanly possible can be done to make sure that our most treasured investment, which are our children, can be, at a minimum, be held harmless in this next cycle. And of course, we'll take anything you can throw our way. with that, Chair Keller is going to talk a little bit about the future.
Well, I have been on the board for 13 years now, and there's been a dramatic change. The first half of those 13 years was building and building and facilities and growth, and where can we put them all? And now, it's even though, you know, with the flat enrollment and the slowdown enrollment, it's been an opportunity for us to really turn back to curriculum needs and be able to provide options for our students and our families. And so that's been a change for the board to work with, but it's been a very successful and very rewarding change. The other thing, as board members, we are here to represent the community, so what we really work hard to do is find a balance between what is best for our students and our families in our district and still being very respectful to the taxpayer dollars. And I think that shows in the numbers that Dr. Amoroso has brought forward with our per pupil spend. So we really work hard at that, and we're very proud of the work that we have done, and that's an ongoing piece all the time. Some of the challenges that we have found recently that we've been spending a lot of time with that I'd like to share with you is one of the pieces Dr. Marosa talked about are the growth of students of color. And where we are at right now is one of the things that the board is working on is an integration and equity plan that we're partnering with Burnsville with. And we are an adjoining district to Burnsville, and they have been identified as racially isolated, and we're working together with the Burnsville School District and with our own district, utilizing and developing a plan to meet the state statute, and we will have very successful outcome for our students with that and for the Burnsville students. Another piece that we have conversations about all the time and that has become, it's back to the MCAs. We do respect the fact that accountability is very important. The board has found that the NWEA is a very successful tool for us to use to assess our children with. It has the accountability and the growth model piece to it. It has immediate results for our district and our teachers to be able to use in the classroom for our students within the given year that that test is given, and to help develop skills and work with our students that need development in areas. And it does take time and money to do these assessments. And understanding that 75% of the school districts across the state have utilized NWEA, we find that a true value of accountability and measurement. And another piece that we have recently been working with is the OPET, the GASB mandate with OPET. And right now we have two options with how to fund that, either out of our general education fund or out of our general education fund or out of bonding. And if we bond, if we choose to bond, what we are really doing is something that's not so favorable to taxpayers within our community. We are having to pay administrative costs as well as interest costs on bonds. And during one of our rather lively discussions we had about this a while back, about a month or so ago, it was brought up from a board member of, like, we would like to have it explored as to whether or not that could be something that could be something we could levy. So as just like we levy the health and safety, it would be a good opportunity for us to be able to do something favorable for our taxpayers to be able to levy these types of dollars as opposed for bonding. And basically, for me to sum this up again, on the 13 years I've been on the school board and the changes I've seen, what we used to go out to our community for was referred to as excess levy referendums. And they're really no longer excess levy referendums. They're now operating levies. And our community has a lot of... Our community has a lot of programming and values that they are willing to support, and that's an easy piece to communicate to the community. But when it comes down to asking for dollars to simply operate the core programming of the community, it gets a little concerning, because we are now losing our protection for, you know, trying to keep class sizes within reasonable means and not having them. You could potentially have buildings that have empty classrooms because we don't have enough teachers to put them in. We have rooms that will be busting at the seams with kids in them. And so we really work hard to try to explain to our community what it is we're trying to do as a board, back to Dr. Amoroso's, the strategic plan that we have in place, to educate our community, listen to our community, and continue to see what they value. Their values have changed over the 13 years I have been on the board, and they will continue to change. And we need to keep being able to make them a part of the system and not feel disfranchised, like they don't have a choice, because everything that comes at us are mandates or, you know, those types of things. We want our community to feel that they have some say in the type of education that we provide to our students.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. I appreciate you taking the time to, from your busy schedules, to testify here tonight. And then, Glenn, if you wanted to come down, while we hear from the Randolph School District, we do have a couple of new members who've come in here. And on my right is, we'll begin with Representative Morgan.
Sorry, should have waited. Thank you. I'm Will Morgan. I am from Burnsville. I have a portion of the Lakeville School District in my legislative district, the northern part, that oddly enough goes to Lakeville South. I've been in the office for, it's my second term, and I'm glad to be here tonight.
Good evening. I'm Representative Marcia Swales from Woodbury, and we apologize for our tardiness. We were at a hearing that was very controversial, and it just ended, and we blasted out of the Capitol to get here.
Representative Swales, did the bill pass or fail?
It passed.
I'm Representative Jim Dabney, represent part of South Minneapolis, teacher on leave from the Buffalo School District in my fifth term here in the Minnesota House.
Good evening. I'm Representative Randy Demmer. I live in Hayfield, which is down near Rochester. I have Dodge County and part of Olmsted County down there, and I am in my fourth term, and I apologize for being late. I was in transportation finance. And if I could, I'm going to offer a greeting from Representative Mary Liz Holberg, who was in the same committee I was, except she had to stay for the next bill, and I didn't. So she said to, she's probably not going to get here, but she felt badly about that and said to send her greetings also.
thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Glenn Woodhouse. I'd like to thank the committee for giving me this opportunity to speak and give a little different perspective to the Farmington and Lakeville school districts. The Randolph School District has approximately 600 students. Our entire K through 12 building will fit inside this one structure. So it's a little, it's such a beautiful structure, and it's nice to see, but it's just so different from the Randolph School District. We're in the southeast corner of Dakota County. We serve the kind of an overlap area of Cannon Falls, Northfield, Hampton, and so we're in the very southeast corner of the metro, which, as I mentioned, we're a very small school district. Randolph itself, the town, is 200 people, so we have a pretty wide area that we draw from, and because of that, it gives us a very different perspective. It's a farming area, you know. There's a lot of growth, as like the Lakeville and Farmington areas have had, but still basically it's a farm community, and we've had just tremendous support from our community with funding. And when we needed a new building, you know, we replaced our 100-year-old building, and we had great support from our community. But what's a little bit different is because we're so small, we don't offer all the programs. We don't have all the sports programs or all the extracurriculars, but we have, you know, the basics. And as part of our school board, how do we offer those programs to students that we don't have? You know, we partner with Dakota County Technical College to offer some of those types of classes to give our students the opportunity to go see that. We co-op with our neighboring school districts to offer athletic programs. How do we, you know, share programs? Because we can't afford to offer a wrestling program for our three students. You know, it just doesn't make economic sense for us to do that. So how do we, as a school board and as an administration, utilize our funding as best that we can? You know, we say in this state that education is a priority. And I would like to believe that even in this economic situation that we're in, that we can at least hold flat. You know, that's what our district is planning on, at least flat, you know, because we're, I think, our total budget is $6 million. So when we hear of, you know, districts cutting $17 million and $6 million, it's my whole budget. You know? So that, you know, I can't necessarily grasp those types of decisions because the magnitude is so different than what we deal with. But grouping and saving and partnering, you know, I think school districts all over the state are already doing those types of things to save money, because funding, you know, as an individual, everything is more expensive today than it was. But is everything keeping up with inflation? Not necessarily. So how do we, as a school district and as good stewards of our taxpayers' money, you know, as a school board, we are stewards of the taxpayers of our, that we represent. You know, it's not, we're not building new buildings, we're not going out and spending money lavishly. You know, we're trying to make sure that we can educate our kids to get them ready for the future. That's our goal, you know, get them ready for the future. And if we're gonna hold flat, at least we're not stepping backwards. You know, going backwards says, what are we going to do in 5 to 10 years when those students get ready to move on to the next phase of their life? So, again, I just wanted to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak, and good luck with the current budget situation you're dealing with.
Thank you. We're going to need it, Glenn. Thanks. for those who came in late, there are two different types of comment cards. There are the green ones, if you would wish to speak and address the committee. There is a white comment card, if you wish to have your thoughts just put down in writing and do not wish to speak today. And before we begin calling on people and allocating time, are there any other cards that people wish to turn into the staff to bring up here? Okay, well, good. So what we'll work on here is the premise. We have about 4 minutes each for each of the people who are testifying. We'll begin with Randy Anderson from Elk River.
Do you just want me to come up and sit down?
Actually, we would prefer if you stood on your head.
Sure.
No, I'm just kidding. No, but yes. And again, please say your name for the day.
Sure. Greetings, representatives. I'm Randy Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of Business Services for Elk River School District. And actually, I live in this area, so I'm very familiar with Farmington and Lakeville and so forth. And I've been with Elk River for about 4 months, and so I've hit the ground running, and I'd like to share a few things with you tonight. And I'd just like to say on behalf of our school board, and I'm here with Tina Groff, and who's part of our legislative action team, and Holly Thompson, who's part of our school board, and on behalf of them and Superintendent Mark Bisek, I thank you for the opportunity of allowing me here to speak on behalf of Elk River Schools. Again, like the previous school districts who have testified and presented, Lakeville, Farmington, Randolph, you have some challenges. And as I've come to Elk River School District, we are unique, and I think like Lakeville and like Farmington, we also have some financial challenges. And even because we are growing, some of these we have no control over. We are only one of the few school districts in the state of Minnesota experiencing exploding growth. Not only are we the ninth largest school district in Minnesota, we have also been the fastest growing school district in Minnesota. To compound matters, like Lakeville, we plan on cutting $8 million over the next 2 years, $6.1 million next year, and we'll have to see and wait what happens with how your session turns out and what the stimulus money is used for. And we, too, have some assumptions built into our budget projections for the next 3 to 5 years. Just to give you an idea of how quickly we've grown, in times of declining enrollment or a flat enrollment, we're sitting in with the company of some anomaly school districts, and being the fastest growing school districts in the state of Minnesota, during the last 5 years, we've added 2,600 new students to our district. And if you put this in perspective, that growth is the equivalent of four new elementary schools. And also to put this in perspective, that five-year increase, that 2,600 students, is more than the total enrollment for about 80% of the school districts in the state of Minnesota. And so it's an interesting anomaly. Needless to say, we've kept the construction business industry up in the Elk River, Zimmerman, and Rogers area, building schools, adding on, etc. We're looking at flat enrollment, maybe minor enrollment because of the economy, but we're looking at it for the future as continuing to be a booming area for growth. And not only do we get the commuters coming from the cities, we get, coming down from St. Cloud, or going into the cities, we also get, coming down from the St. Cloud area. So again, I just like to talk to you a little bit about, I've had some handouts here that kind of compare us of some of our challenges. And as you can see, I handed out a sheet that shows us in comparison with some of our similar sized school districts. I looked at school districts that were approximately over 7,500 students. And as you can see there, our general ed general revenue funding is at about $6,989 per pupil, and it's about $500 behind the state average. And if we had this just the state average, that would be about $7 million additional dollars to our budget, which would obviously prevent the budget cuts that we're going to have to do for next year. That would be about $7 million additional dollars to our budget, which would obviously prevent the budget cuts that we're going to have to do for next year. Again, as you're looking at the Minnesota Miracle, as you're looking at some of those new ventures and you move forward, we're excited about those opportunities that the new miracle may bring. Our taxpayers are paying their fair share. And this is the one thing I want to talk to you a little bit about because it's unique, I think, to growing school districts. Our taxpayers are paying their fair share towards our student education. They're contributing 36% of the anticipated net tax capacity toward the funding of our school district. As you can see there, we have about 36%. The average of those metro schools that I've shown you there is about 29%. Of all the metro school districts, and I didn't do this comparison, but I'll bet that we're probably the only district that actually levies more for debt service. A higher percentage of our levy goes to the payment of debt service than it actually does towards operating referendum or mandated shifts, so to speak, of those levies. So in other words, as you can see from our chart, we have 57% of the proper taxpayers' taxes levy goes towards the payment of debt service on our buildings compared to the metro average of 35%. This leaves approximately 43% going toward of our local property taxes levy going towards our operations, compared to 65% of those districts that I've shown you there, our metro peers. Again, we do have a $698 operating referendum in place, but it is $436 less than those comparable districts I showed you there. If we had that average, that would again add about $6 million additional funds to our budget. But now, if you look at that comparison, we're already looking at levying 36% of our anticipated net tax capacity. 57% of that is going towards debt service. 43% is going to operating referendum. We have one of the lowest operating referendums in that comparison. We have a hard time going out with our handout now, okay? It's tough. It's putting us kind of in a quandary. We're unique in that, you know, we're spending our money, our property taxpayers, they've approved all these building projects to keep up with that growth, to provide schools and building needs for our kids. And now we've kind of, you know, it's tough. Taxpayers, they're saturated. They're giving their fair share, and right now for us to go out with our handout it's going to be a tough sell. And I just wanted to kind of share with you some of those unique things in our school district, and we're trying to address some of these issues. Our budget assumptions are flat, you know, funding for the next year, 2 years. We realize that the stimulus money is coming in. We still haven't figured out quite what that's going to impact. But I guess what we're asking you is just kind of three things. Our Legislative Action Committee has kind of put three things in place. One is there's some loose levy language in there that allows you to add on to an existing structure up to 20% of the square footage of that building. And we're asking you to increase that to 30%. That will help us, you know, in the future with some additions if we need to. We're bursting at the seams at some of our buildings now. That will allow us to do that. Second of all, I think Lakeville and Farmington both talked about this, the 2% staff development restriction. We're asking you to temporarily repeal that and give us the opportunity to use those funds as part of our operations for the next 2 years. We've had some additional talks with our union, and I think they're supportive, and we're working with them just in case. And third, growing school districts like ours, we're looking for you to recognize specifically maybe some. I realize that funding is going to be tight, and there's no money out there, but realize that there are anomaly school districts that are growing, and that maybe there can be some kind of adjustment to school funding to recognize the challenges of these exceptionally growing districts. You know, like I said, right now, that's heartfelt with our property taxpayers. And I know you have a tough job ahead of you, and I wish you good luck, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And thank you for reminding me that when I'm going to have a four limit time limit, I need to keep track and press right before I do. That's my fault, not yours. So thank you very much. And
Chairman, may I ask a question?
Oh, boy. When I was in Representative Dietrich's district, I played a little practical joke on her, and I thought for sure that was the payback about to come. So did you have a question, Representative Dietrich? Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, I'm just curious about, is there a bill introduced that would allow up to 30% of the existing square footage for the lease levy?
I think that's what he introduces.
Oh.
Representative Dietrich.
And may I ask Chairwoman Gradling something?
You can work through the chair, Representative Dietrich.
Yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Representative Gradling, are we going to hear that bill?
Representative Gradling.
I'm looking back to the staff to see if we have that one on our thing. It doesn't look like we are. No bill introduction. We have we scheduled all the bills that we were going to hear up until this week, and now all of our committee hearings are full. So bills that haven't yet been introduced would be in pretty tough shape to get hearings this year. We have next year, of course, too.
Representative Dietrich, anything else?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Todd.
There you are. Sorry.
Come on down. Again, please state your name for the tape.
Todd Kirich, resident of Lakeville, teacher in Independent School District 192, which is Farmington, in the Social Studies Department, and just to show my vested interest in testifying before you tonight, president of the Farmington Education Association, Local 7086, and capitalist, and father of a two-year-old in the soon-to-be Lakeville School District. Chair Grayling, Representative Groflo, and the rest of the committee for staff, just want to say thank you for coming down to Farmington tonight, south of the river. We really, really appreciate it. I also want to thank all the district staff from Independent School District 192, especially in particular the teachers from the Farmington Education Association for coming out tonight, and other members of Lakeville and Randolph, just to show you the interest that we do have in public education. Few points that I just wanted to speak with you tonight, and the best way that I know how to do it is to do it through a story that I usually tell my students when I start to teach U.S. history. In 1923 or so, my grandfather was born, and he was born in Hibbing, Minnesota, and during the course of the Great Depression, he had to go work on a fruit ranch. He had to leave home. He came from a very large family. There was like 12 kids. And on December 7th of 1941, he returned home, enlisted in the United States Marines, and soon found himself in the Solomon Islands and was on the first wave of troops going in the Guadalcanal in World War II. And when I was growing up as a kid, he would always ask me about school, and I never quite understood why. And I wasn't quite sure what he was so obsessive about school. He'd always ask me about it. Well, by the time I started getting into my upper levels of high school, I finally figured it out. My grandpa stopped going to school when he was in eighth grade and never had the opportunity. And I always wanted the opportunity, but when he came home, he ended up working right away. And he didn't take advantage of the GI Bill, but he ended up working, starting a family. And as I went into college, he said to me, he's like, you know, this is what makes this country great. And to paraphrase, he said, this is what I fought for. I fought for you to have these opportunities. Well, I'm in a community here in Lakeville where I just read an article in the paper where I know how great their school district is doing, and they got to cut their staff development. And he just got done being told that there's over 30 different languages being spoke within their school district, and trying to get people ready to take that on is a very, very, very big thing. Within my own school district, in Farmington here, I see great people in a community oftentimes divided over how are they going to fund education. And, you know, to relay a couple of figures to you, inflation-adjusted state funding for education has fallen 14% since 2003. Minnesota students are seeing increasing class sizes across the state, cuts to academic and extracurricular programs, college tuition costs are soaring to unaffordable levels for many Minnesotans. The problems continue to get worse, as you're hearing about, and this burden has been shifted back to local school districts that are forced to seek operating levies from property taxpayers. In 1980, less than a quarter of school districts had operating levies in place. By 2007, 90% did. This trend must be reversed if we're to give our students the world-class education that they deserve and that my grandfather and I'm sure many of your relatives fought for to make this country great.
Todd, about 1 minute, okay.
In higher education, funding problems manifest themselves in increased tuition costs. I know this because I'm still a college student right now. Mm-hmm. According to the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, over the last 10 years, inflation-adjusted tuition has increased at the University of Minnesota 73%. Tuition at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and four-year universities have increased 66% and 57% at two-year colleges. Private four-year colleges in Minnesota saw their tuition increase by 64%. This is turning into a me generation, and we need to be the greatest generation that Tom Brokaw talked about and be a we generation. And that starts with public education. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thanks, Todd. Denise. How do I pronounce your last name?
Speck.
Speck, okay. Having had my last name butchered several times since I was a little boy, I just don't want to.
I can definitely.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Denise Speck. Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, and honorable members of the committee, good evening. As I stated earlier, my name is Denise Speck, and I'm an elementary teacher on leave from Centennial School District, now serving as Secretary Treasurer with Education Minnesota, representing 70,000 educators across the state. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk with you tonight, and thank you for being here. We support the new Minnesota Miracle, and we appreciate Representative Greiling's leadership on this legislation. This plan provides additional resources for schools and contains important funding reforms. As we've said repeatedly over the last several months, we need to fundamentally fix the school funding system in Minnesota. We believe any funding system should meet these four principles. It must be equitable. A child's education should not depend on the zip code in which they live. It must be sustainable and come from stable sources that withstand the inevitable downturns in the economy. Funding should be predictable. Schools shouldn't be wondering year to year if they'll have adequate funding. And it must be sufficient, enough to meet defined expectations. We believe the new Minnesota Miracle addresses our funding principles. It helps us move toward a more equitable funding system by funding all-day kindergarten and by providing all school districts, regardless of whether they have a referendum on the books. It would be predictable because it would ease the funding problems for districts losing students by decreasing funding gradually rather than drastically each year. And it would fully fund special education, as well as contain an inflationary protection, allowing the formula to increase without legislative action. The Minnesota Miracle would be sustainable because it commits the state to long-term funding of education, lessening the need for school levies, and it would provide sufficient additional funding for education, putting the state back on the road toward funding sufficiency. Education Minnesota will continue to work with Representative Greiling as this proposal moves toward the legislature to ensure that it meets our funding principles. Thank you, Representative Greiling, for sponsoring this important legislation that addresses in a very comprehensive way the needs for Minnesota students and educators. We look forward to working with you. Thank you for your consideration of my testimony, and thank you for having me.
Thanks. Craig Davis. You look surprised, Craig. She does not appreciate your joke, Craig.
You got to be kidding me.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Gladly. Good afternoon. My name is Craig Davis, a Farmington community member. Representative Greiling and Representative Raffalo, colleagues on the committee, thank you very much for coming down here. This is a very interesting opportunity for you all to come down here and allow folks like myself to speak in front of you. I could probably spend a little more than 4 minutes up here, as some of the people in the audience would confess to for me, but what I'm going to start off with is a newspaper article
I have a history of sometimes assaulting the sensibilities of the Farmington School Board with newspaper articles that I've gathered. I'm a pilot with Northwest Airlines, the New Delta, and it's always fascinating me to travel about the country and even about the world there and see a lot of the similar challenges and issues that confront people everywhere. I will quickly say, I hope, and I would like to discourage the committee any kind of recommendation that you look at the idea of cutting educational funding. A zero funding for the school districts here in Minnesota is basically a negative funding. If you look at the cost of health insurance, fuel will go back up, food prices, et cetera, et cetera. Things will increase. Maybe not so much this year. I choose to be optimistic. This economic recession, anybody that looks at the history of these things, this will end. Things will get better. If you cut, you take the chance, perhaps not in the Farmington district. We seem to be very well positioned here financially. But there are outlying areas, districts, that are not in good financial position. If you cut, you take the chance of robbing children from quality education. What I've read in the past, if you give a child 1 year of we'll call it a poor education, it can take 2 to 3 years to make that up. There's another old adage out there, and I've heard this one frequently through my life, you get what you pay for. Again, I urge you all to reflect on that. My newspaper article last week, Pioneer Press, Derwin Long, a professor at St. Thomas University, had a very very good article or column that he presented. And we've heard here about we always hear about the importance of an education, and yeah, it's a good thing, and this and that. I think it helps sometimes to put a perspective on there, to quantify it, if you will. And I'd like to extract a couple of items here from his article. Over the past 34 years, the average income of high school graduates has fallen in real terms by 1%, while bachelor's degree holders have seen their real incomes increase by 19%. Today, the average American with a college degree earns 2.8 times more than a worker with only a high school diploma, and is only half as likely to be unemployed at any given time. Workers with an education beyond a bachelor's degree fare even better. From Georgetown University's Center on Education and Workforce estimates that approximately two-thirds of the jobs to be created by the federal government's recent stimulus package will require a college degree or post-secondary credential. Longer term, labor experts predict that 50% of the new jobs that will be created in the U.S. during the next decade will require some form of post-secondary education. Human capital, like infrastructure, requires ongoing reinvestment. Critical role of government. State government in particular must play a central role in preparing Minnesotans to thrive in an increasingly competitive global marketplace. Quality education is the key, including a commitment to early childhood education, quality K-12 schooling, increased college readiness among high school graduates. And of course, preparing for college that means nothing if students cannot afford the cost of attendance, so policymakers and educators must work hard to solve the problem of escalating college costs. That one hits me very close to the heart here. I have, what do we have now? 3 kids in college. Okay, it's not pretty. To me, and talking with other adults who put their kids through college, I think it is incredibly unconscionable that kids nowadays are coming out of college with a degree and they have tens of thousands of dollars in debt, if they're lucky. I'm flabbergasted with the stories I hear with kids that have debt, six-figure debt loads. That is unbelievable. I told my son the other day when I came out of college in 19... Oh, forget that. I had one loan that was for $1,000. How can we do that to our kids? I don't understand it. And then we read about the forecast here of... We think we're going through a financial Armageddon right now. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, but you know what's going to happen here in about 20 years when Medicare, Medicaid is swamped Social Security is swamped, and the rest of the tax revenue will pay off the interest. Well, after this year, that's probably maybe part of the interest on the federal debt load. Right. And these are the same kids that are going to be carrying these incredible debt loads coming out of college. And there's an interesting game that we're playing with ourselves out there, and we don't seem to face reality. I don't quite get it. The previous speaker, I thought, did a very good job there talking about some of the inequities and things that are going on out there. She also talked about the importance of funding pre-K, and I would like to reiterate, kindergarten all day, every day. Okay, we have an abbreviated form of that here in this district. Some other districts are trying to do that. So much of it goes back to the this game out here. Okay, you know, we've all heard about weapons proliferation, and there's another term for it, excuse me, right now. But something that goes on right now in this state is this referendum game. Some districts can do it, some districts cannot. And so much of it comes down to how well they're able to go out and market a referendum. These folks back here, these superintendents, these school board members, the staff that teaches in our classrooms, these folks, these are not marketers. They're educators. They're not in the business of going out and having every couple of years now trying to market referendums. It's crazy. It's a waste of time for these people. They need to spend their time in the classroom providing quality education for our folks. You've heard some things about English as a second language, and I'm going to throw in a quick little clip here. We have another board member here. She was not introduced, Veronica Walter.
Oh, hi.
Farmington. And NWEA, that's a great testing system. Okay, I am not a fan of MCAs. I'm not a fan. I think they're kind of a joke. Don't tell anybody. I know you have to play the game, or you'll lose the federal funding. An outstanding testing mechanism is this NWEA. It tests at least three times during the year. Okay, horizontal single day snapshot testing is a joke. Okay, it is an unconscionable wager on a result. Okay, test these kids in a vertical method. Follow each individual child. Test them. See how well they do. How am I doing? Seconds?
You're over time.
But I should. We should point out that you are not just an average citizen who happened to study the NWA. You have a little bit of history with this.
I'm a humble community member. Thank you very much.
Yeah, former school board member. So that's how correct it. And last but certainly not least, Peggy.
Do
I try that? No, I'm going to. I should. I'm just going to go with. Never mind. Go ahead, Peggy.
Carolyn Garofalo, Representative Grimey. My name is Peggy Januszka. It depends on who you talk to in my husband's family, how you pronounce that. I am a teacher here in Farmington. I work at Farmington Middle School East. I teach 7th grade science and have done so for 28 wonderful years. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. And so what has funding done to our students in our classroom? And from my perspective, in having 28 years, I have a lot of time to reflect. And when I first started, I remember the discussion about capping class sizes, and being a science teacher in the lab, we were trying to keep it at 24 students. Our current high school has a lab set up just for that. There's six of those tables, permanent tables. Right now, we have, if we're lucky, we have 32 in a classroom. And doing lab classes, whether it's facts, whether it's tech ed, whether it's science, whether it's English, trying to, teach kids learning and writing, giving 32 kids scalpels when they're dissecting, trying to get around to each of those kids, it's a real challenge. And I sometimes feel like I should get a job at Sonic so I can practice the roller skating, because I sometimes feel like I have to do that to get to them, whether it's dissecting or whether it's at the microscope. It's just a real challenge. The other thing is our staff development monies. also reflecting back at a time where I remember having $2,000 for our entire staff to do any professional development. It didn't go very far. We have had the opportunity to have more money, and I tell you, our school uses it really well. Our district uses it very, very well. Whether it's getting additional training, I'm a science teacher, but I'm being trained in reading strategies so I can apply those reading strategies within my classroom. Taking the time to teach kids how to do that. I never thought in a million years that I'd be doing that as a science teacher. And I couldn't do that without our staff development money. Right after school, we have an opportunity through our staff development committee to offer a learning academy. And one of our teacher requirements for relicensure is there's four areas that we have to have, and one of them is knowing the early signs of mental illness. And that was one of the things that our learning academy offered. So I could have that requirement. And you know, as I look at those adolescents, and you got to wonder how many of them are dealing with some of those issues and being able to be aware of that. So we definitely need to have fundamental fix to our funding system. And I appreciate the efforts of Representative Greiling and others who put forth the new Minnesota Miracle to address that issue. I think that's great. We all share in the desire to provide the best possible education to our kids. And we need those resources to provide quality educators, getting that class size in control, getting up-to-date materials, technology, and as well as to continue and support teachers so they can, to continue their professional development so we can help our kids be the best that they can be. So thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. And in conclusion for the hearing, I'm really thankful for the opportunity that Chair Greiling has given to the committee and to myself and the members of the community to be accessible. It's always nice when we can bring the capital to the people as opposed to forcing the people to be to the capital. And we actually do agree on quite a few things, even though we're in different parties. And it's important for people to know that Representative Greiling and I have a good working relationship. It's especially important because in a couple of weeks we're going to rip each other's faces off on the House floor. No, we're not going to do that, no. But I did want to say thank you very much. And you know, when we have these meetings, there's always a concern that you're going to open it up and you're going to have two people show up and you're going to be looking at a room full of empty chairs. I'm just very thankful that such a strong showing from the community and everyone being here today. And I can say that not just as a legislator, but as a father whose kids go to public schools in Farmington and his wife teaches in the district. So that really means a lot to me. So with that, that's the end of our meeting, and thank you very much for participating. This meeting is adjourned.